Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our August 1st meeting. If you all rise, please, and join me in the flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
With that, Madam Clerk, if you read any changes to our calendar, please.
You have a couple of changes to today's calendar. Item C1, hearing to consider the formation of a zone of benefit and a request to call a special tax election in Cimarron Way Road Improvement Zone of County Service Area Number 9, located in Los Osos, Baywood Park, 2nd District. Staff is requesting that the attached resolution calling for a special election be added to the staff report. Under added hearing items, you have C5, hearing to consider an appeal by Nathan and April Vasquez of the denial of a curb gutter and sidewalk waiver, request ERC 2005-00192, located at 1343 L Street in the community of San Miguel, 1st District. This item was continued from July 25, 2006. Recommend approval of the appeal. Staff is requesting that this item be heard following the noon recess. All requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour noticing requirement. Under added items for closed session, you have conference with real property negotiator. Number 11 is being added. Property description is 4388 Santa Fe Road in San Luis Obispo. Parties with whom negotiating, Roy Kaufman, CB&I Constructors, Inc. Instructions to negotiator will concern price, terms, and conditions. All requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour noticing requirement. That's your changes for today.
Thank you. With that, we'll move forward with the presentation. I will entertain a motion for approval.
Second.
Moved by Supervisor Ovid, seconded by Supervisor Lenthal. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Yes.
Aye. Okay. With that, Mr. Mutziger? Or would it be Andy or...
Good morning. My name is Lisa Quinn. I'm the program coordinator for Regional Rideshare. And we're here today. Jessica Berry is also here from Regional Rideshare. She's the bicycle coordinator. We're here today to share with you some of the highlights from this past bike month, which happened in May. I also would like to note that many of the cities were involved as they had proclamations out to the different proclaiming bike month, which is the first to happen this year. We really made an effort to be more inclusive to the whole county. So with no further ado, we'll show you the presentation.
Okay.
And hopefully, we had some technological problems, so hopefully you'll be able to see this. And I'll be happy to burn you a CD later.
Okay.
Ongoing support of Bike Month. We, with this, it's encouraged a lot more people to get out and cycle. Hopefully you see more people and you can encourage more people in your communities to get out and help them cycle. With that, I'd like to present Mr. Patterson with a card of the people that went down the grade and the ride that he led during Bike Week.
Thank you. Would you like to comment?
Well, that happened in May, and I just want to say that I'm still here to talk about it. It was a great event. We had 12 people meet in Santa Margarita and commute to work on that particular Tuesday, and many of those folks are still doing it. I've made it a few times, but I usually intercept the bus and either bring that down or take it home with my bike. So hopefully it'll encourage others to do the same. Thank you, Lisa, and thank you, Alan.
Hi, I'm Andy Mussiger with the San Luis Obispo County Air Pollution Control District. And on behalf of the Regional Rideshare, the San Luis Obispo County Bicycle Coalition, and the Air Pollution Control District, I'd like to just highlight some of the good things that happened during Bike Month. With the high price of fuels these days, Bike Month is a great opportunity to demonstrate the bike as an excellent alternative transportation mode. The Bike Month Committee, as you saw, developed or promoted 15 different events throughout the month of May. One of those was Bike Fest that we saw a lot of great pictures from. That was held in conjunction with the Farmers Market. Encouraging our communities to bicycle saves the community money, and more importantly, supporting cycling reduces air pollution, global warming impacts, and congestion, all of which helps create a healthier place to live, work, and play. One of the things that the Air Pollution Control District did in this effort was we had a group of us that were working on the Bike Month Committee to help identify all these great events. And as you saw, there was a widespread support of Bike Month throughout the community. There were a lot of businesses that participated, and it was a very fun-filled month. One of those events that the Air District specifically worked on was the community happening in Bike and Movie. And that was a real fun event. We had about 150 people that participated in that. And it took what has been happening here in the county for about 5 years, the happening, on a biking event that happens the first Thursday of every month, and took it to a wider range of people. It was earlier in the evening on a Friday, and at the end of our little ride through downtown San Luis Obispo, we wound up at Meadow Park, and we showed a movie there. It was a very fun event. So with that, I'd like to close.
Thank you. With that, we'll move forward with our agenda. Next item is public comment. First speaker is Mr. Graham, followed by Jack Bisek. That might take a while to warm up. If you want to use the others, you're welcome to do so.
This microphone? The microphone?
Yeah, but you got to push on the bottom.
I think it's on now. Is it on now?
Yep.
Can you hear me yet? Rising and?
No, not yet.
Not yet.
But it has to.
Help is on the way.
Help is on the way, right
help
there.
Help is on the way.
Good morning, Supervisor Ashajian, Board. My name is Terrell Graham. I'm a 26-year resident of the city of Atascadero. I've run for city council 3 times, and during that same period of time, I've been litigating with Atascadero and then finally with the San Luis Obispo County Board. Last week, when I tried to take out nomination papers to become a city councilman, they denied that any such title existed that I wanted to be listed by. So I came today to show you the source of my authority. Last week I showed you the Rehnquist book. This explains that in 1991, the Supreme Court became completely conservative. And their idea, along with our founding fathers, was to place all power with the people. Our government exists to serve the people. What's happening right now with some of the controversies here is that the Bush administration has decided to skip over the Attorney General and the legislature of California and influence the local county government on marijuana initiation. So what San Luis Obispo County has chosen to do is go under the martial law theory of unitarian government and paying no attention to the judiciary. I'll try and focus this a little bit better. It's difficult when you're using tricky stuff. And there it is, right there. It says, the court started a federal attack on federal power using private individuals and public interest organizations to act as private attorney generals. That was my designation from the California Supreme Court. When I arrived in Washington, the great reward was a library card. When you arrive at the Supreme Court, you're given a certificate to go to the Library of Congress, and at the Library of Congress you receive a card that admits you into the law library of the Library of Congress. This is the only reward I've had for prosecuting this lawsuit for about 25 years.
Mr. Graham?
Thank you.
Sorry, sir, your time is up. Mr. Yuseka, followed by Richard Howley.
Good morning. My name is Jack Bisek. I live at 2829 C Canyon Road. I'm a 35-year resident of San Luis County and a former member of the Avila Valley Advisory Council, and I'm here to speak of my own opinion and in support of Senate Bill 1632 that I want you to be aware of. I've followed the development of Diablo Canyon, and I'm concerned about our diligence. As you all know, we were promised many times that radioactive waste would be stored in a repository to be provided by the government, and these promises have been broken repeatedly. They've been replaced with new promises that will be broken, I believe. And shouldn't we be thinking, fool us once, shame on PG&E and the government, fool us again and again, shame on us. Radioactivity lasts what? 10,000 years, that'd be right, 10,000 years. In the 70s, the cost of Diablo was estimated at $800 million. Now, in 2006, just the cost of replacing the steam generators is $800 million or more. So what's up with that? Inflation? Aren't we passing some bills onto future ratepayers? Aren't we passing serious problems onto future boards of supervisors? I don't think we want to put this burden on future generations, and I ask us to take a closer look and do the diligence on this, to explore issues like seismic risk, like terrorism, and the aging of an outmoded nuclear plant. Aren't we supposed to be stewards of this beautiful land and resources? And aren't you supposed to be looking out for our best interests? When did we lose the ethic of leave the world a better place than you found it? Are you going to allow Diablo to become a permanent waste site? Because you know in your heart of hearts that all the promises to move the storage cask is just rhetoric. If the commitment was real, you would put it in writing, and I don't see any such agreement taking place. Where is our diligence on this? I believe the right thing to do is to support Senate Bill 1632, put the brakes on construction, hold the show, find out what the risks really are, and before moving ahead any further, take a closer look. Otherwise, let's call a spade, and call it the Diablo Canyon nuclear waste dump, and be honest about it. This board has an opportunity to investigate some very important issues facing Diablo Canyon. Let's support the work of Assemblyman Blakesley, who helped author this bill, as well as the work of Senator Wesley Chesbro from Northern California, where the Humboldt nuclear power plant was closed in 1976 and still some 30 years later been decommissioned.
Your time is up.
Sorry. Thank you. Please support Senate Bill 1632.
Sir Howley, followed by Camila Fox.
Good morning, Honorable Board, Chairperson. My name is Richard Hawley, and I'm the Executive Director of Green Space, the Cambria Land Trust. And I'd like to talk a little bit about the process with the wildlife feeding ordinance that happened a week or so ago. And it's about balance. And I know each one of the board members here takes balance in the process of democracy very seriously. I've witnessed that for 35 years. What we did find out is how each one of the board members felt about this proposed ordinance, but what's missing in this equation is how the opposition felt, how the people who support this ordinance feels, and how they would like to express their opinions on it. And I know that this is certainly something you each take at heart. You hear a lot of different things, from marijuana ID cards to nuclear waste and entertaining the idea of a wildlife feeding ordinance is something that you owe your constituents. And I'm hoping that soon you might agendize that ordinance again, listen to what other people have to say, listen to the facts from the other side, maybe make a compromise with the ordinance that was presented, maybe not, but at least give your constituents the opportunity to voice their opinion on it. And I know this is important to you, how your constituents feel. Whether you agree with them or not in the final end is really beside the point. It's the process that matters. And I'm hoping you will entertain that. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Ms. Fox, followed by Christopher Papuchis.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. My name is Camilla Fox. I'm Director of Wildlife Programs with the Animal Protection Institute. And I speak to you today on behalf of the 27,000 San Luis Obispo County members of the Animal Protection Institute and the Humane Society of the United States. And I also wish to address the wildlife feeding ordinance, which I know was scheduled to be heard and voted on today. The Animal Protection Institute has worked with several communities throughout California to enact local ordinances prohibiting wildlife feeding at the municipal and county levels. Why, some have asked, is a wildlife feeding ordinance even necessary? Each year in San Luis Obispo County alone, approximately 1,600 animals are killed under the USDA Wildlife Services Program at taxpayer expense. Of these, an estimated 400 to 500 animals are killed in urbanized areas of the county. Wildlife Services and the California Department of Fish and Game have acknowledged that wildlife feeding is a common cause of conflicts between people, pets, and wildlife. Unfortunately, it is most often the wild animals that pay the price. In addition to a large number of animals that are killed as a result of habituation to humanized landscapes, wildlife feeding can lead to dangerous situations for people and their pets. For example, coyote attacks on humans, while rare, have been directly associated with intentional or unintentional feeding. I know that other speakers will address this issue specific to mountain lions, so I will simply say that ensuring public safety is a significant reason for addressing wildlife feeding at the local level. Wildlife feeding can also exacerbate disease transmission by concentrating wildlife populations in specific areas. For this reason alone, many state and federal wildlife management agencies highlight the importance of addressing wildlife feeding, particularly at a time when wildlife diseases are at an all-time high. The California Department of Fish and Game recognizes wildlife feeding to be a significant factor in human-wildlife conflicts. While there are two state regulations that purport to address the harassment of wildlife feeding and the feeding of big game animals, the department openly acknowledges the inadequacies of these regulations because of poor wording and vague definitions. In discussing this recently with the head lieutenant of the Department of Fish and Game headquarters, she said that because of the lack of enforceability of these two state regulations, that, quote, "I think local wildlife feeding ordinances are a great idea and the best solution to this issue. I think that's where it needs to come from and start at the local level," end of quote. Moreover, this Department of Fish and Game lieutenant said that on any given day, there are approximately 109 wardens statewide, so wildlife feeding is simply not something their wardens have time to focus on. Put simply, a wildlife feeding ordinance will help alleviate human-wildlife conflicts, reduce the number of animals killed as a result of such conflicts, protect public health and safety, and reduce the likelihood of wildlife disease transmission.
Thank you. Your time is up. I'm sorry. Mr. Papuchis, followed by Daphne Fashion.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. My name is Chris Papuchis, and I'm the wildlife biologist for the Mountain Lion Foundation, a national conservation organization based in California. I had originally planned on testifying today on behalf of our nearly 500 members in the county in support of Supervisor Patterson's wildlife feeding ordinance. We understand that it has been removed from the agenda for today, but at the same time, I would still like to offer our perspective why it's important to deal with wildlife feeding in the county and why it's a benefit to people, pets, and wildlife. First, let me say that reducing conflict between mountain lion and people is of real significance to anyone living, working, or recreating in mountain lion country. The Mountain Lion Foundation is dedicated to working with communities across the state, and we have worked with biologists and wardens from the Department of Fish and Game, local officials, local residents, and agricultural groups such as 4-H and FFA to really get at the root cause of conflicts. And over the past several years, we have found that our conclusions have matched those of mountain lion experts across the world, and that is that most mountain lion conflicts with people are the result of feeding of prey species, including deer, by people, usually inadvertently. Specifically, I'd like to refer to the Cougar Management Guidelines, which were published in 2005 by 13 of the world's leading experts on mountain lions with over 200 cumulative years of experience. This science-based document provides specific recommendations to reduce the likelihood of conflicts. These are, and let me quote, do not attract deer by providing food, e.g. corn and apples, or landscaping with plants palatable to deer. Do not let pets roam or leave pet food outside where it can attract wild animals. Domestic animals that are left unprotected may bait cougars into human communities, putting the pet, the pet's owners, and the cougar at greater risk for a negative encounter. These recommendations are similar to those put forth by California Department of Fish and Game. Now, clearly, though, the feeding ordinance put forth by Supervisor Patterson is not designed to get at all of these root causes of conflicts, it does provide a mechanism by which county officials could increase public safety while also protecting the county's wildlife. We have given several presentations in the county over the past year towards education on this issue. At the same time, education, unfortunately, is not always enough. Even when most members of a neighborhood act responsibly to promote public safety and protect wildlife, the actions of a single individual may cancel out the efforts of the community and place people, pets, and wildlife in jeopardy. As such, the wildlife feeding ordinance, and I know a lot of the opposition to it, has been over concern that this is really a punitive ordinance, but my understanding and my reading of this is this ordinance is not designed to punish, but rather to protect and enhance public safety and protect the wildlife of this county. In closing, I'd like to thank you for your consideration of these comments, and please reconsider your perspective on this issue. Thank you very much for your time.
Ms. Fashion, followed by Michael Kovacs.
Good morning, Board. I've been asked to read a statement by...
Would you please give us your name for the record?
What?
Would you please give us your name for the record?
My name is Daphne Farsing.
Thank you.
This is from Karina Jones. I was extremely disappointed to learn that at last week's supervisors meeting, the Board voted 4-1 against having a public hearing regarding the proposed wildlife feeding ordinance. I raise strong objection to this, as I believe in the democratic process of allowing the public and wildlife experts to weigh in on a matter that is vital to the healthy coexistence of county residents with our native wildlife. It was decided that education was the first path to take. With that said, I propose that the education process first begin with the Board through holding a public hearing. I believe a decision about the fate of the ordinance was made too hastily before all the information was on the table. I live in Atascadero, west Atascadero, and have personally witnessed firsthand many real and significant problems of residents intentionally feeding wildlife. Although I've been an avid supporter of the proposed ordinance, I understand some of the concerns brought forward by opponents. At last week's meeting, Nipomo resident Mike Wynn made some excellent comments expressing the concerns of residents who currently oppose the proposed ordinance. He said that although he is sympathetic to it, his concern is that it is overreaching for a county that is largely rural. He suggests that the language be improved to focus more on the direct intent to feed wildlife. Then it could be brought back as an ordinance that we could all live with. In recognizing that our county is predominantly rural and continues to grow, we can only expect an increased number of wildlife conflicts to ensue as there is further development into wildlife habitat. Wildlife Services and the Department of Fish and Game field thousands of wildlife conflict calls every year. Wildlife Services reports that last year alone, about 500 animals were killed by county trappers due to urban conflicts. However, that statistic does not reflect the large number of animals killed or injured by people hitting them with cars in residential areas, by poisons or by disease and overpopulation. Currently, the board is requesting more education. However, a great deal of public education already exists through local and national efforts. The reality is that education only goes so far. With some people, self-gratification is more important than keeping the wildlife wild. In ending, I'd like to cite an incident I just recently encountered while visiting San Simeon. At the beach, I noticed a half dozen people feeding the ground squirrels their sandwiches in front of a sign that reads, "Do not feed the wildlife." The tragedy is that these squirrels are habituated to human food and will likely be poisoned because they have become a nuisance and overpopulated.
Thank you, ma'am.
Could I please have 3 minutes on my own time? This was for Karina's time.
I'm sorry.
Very short one. Please.
If I do that for you, I have to do it for everybody else.
And I just have a short comment of my own if I could have it on my time. Please.
What is the consensus of the board? Yeah. If it's written down, why don't you present it to us and we'll read it? Because, again, I'll be happy to do it for you, but then I have to do it for everybody else. My apologies. But if you have it written down, we'll be happy to accept it. Or we can make copies and give your original back to you. Thank you, ma'am. Mr. Kovacs, followed by Pete Evans.
Good morning. I'm Michael Kovacs.
Mr. Kovacs, excuse me for interrupting, but if somebody else who hasn't spoken or wasn't planning on speaking would like to speak on or read Mrs. Fashion's letter, you're welcome to do so. That way we're not violating any rule of thumb here. Mr. Kovacs, please.
Yes, thank you. I am Michael Kovacs, one of the citizens for honest representation from District Number 5. First and foremost, though belatedly, I wish many, many happy birthdays to President Bush, who was 60 years old last month. We like him very much, not only because he is one of the greatest presidents, but also for he is listening to citizens. He's answering our questions and comments, and in general for his public sensitivity during his administration. I wish I can see the same of your board in general and my supervisor Patterson in particular. I've been coming here for 18 years, on and off, very frequently at certain time, but I am thinning it out. No point in coming here anymore. Nobody listens to us, and nobody considers our fine and viable inputs and recommendations relevant to these agenda items. My friend, Eric Green, the citizen of San Luis Obispo County, he has been coming here for decades, and he had made many hundreds of recommendations, and practically he has been left on. I don't ever remember the board has amended or disapproved any of these recommendations made in these agendas. I don't remember one item. When I made some recommendations or questions to the board or to Dr. Edge, the chief executive officer of our county, he dismissed it by saying, "I disagree. When are you going to make some changes in this department? We don't want to be governed by Dr. Edge. We want you to be more public sensitive and listen to us."
Pete Evans, followed by Rochelle Becker.
Hello, my name is Pete Evans. I live in San Luis Obispo. I've been a member of the community since 1969. The topic but my chat this morning is energy. And I'd like to make some references to some of the previous speakers, especially the gentleman from the wildlife organization, where he said the actions of few can negate the actions of many in these communities with feeding and so on of the wildlife. My specific interest is strolling through town last week during the energy crisis. I believe the governor called it a level 2 crisis. I noticed the vast majority of our commercial establishments had their doors wide open and their air conditioning on full blast, and of course hundreds of lights on. Some of these places weren't even open for business. I did talk to some of the proprietors. Some were locally owned and some are chains that are owned by people in Omaha or Taipei, I don't know. And by and large, their ultimate response to my question about their seemingly energy abuse or waste was that it's store policy because the shoppers are more inclined to enter their establishment and purchase something if they don't have to open a door. And that makes, I guess, perfect business sense, but I see this as a kind of an inherent evil in this day and age. We can't afford to live like this. It's not right. People died in the state. I believe we had some brownouts in Paso Robles. We just can't afford it. This is a global warming, a national security issue, common sense. And I'm here today to try to raise your awareness and that of the public about these issues and see if we can conserve more energy, because conservation is the cheapest way to get energy. It's just like the penny saved is a penny earned. And we cannot be shoveling energy out of our doors and windows any longer on this planet. We can't afford it. Our children or grandchildren will not have any. And it's incumbent on all of us to do all we can to conserve. On the bicycle presentation, the first thing you saw today, I noticed one of the sponsors of the Bike Month was a violator of this situation last week. Door wide open, frigid air cooling the sidewalk. This happens everywhere. And I've contacted many people, many organizations, and this debate will be going on, and I hope you will join in, talk to your friends, your pardon me, your family, and political counterparts, and discuss this issue and see what we can do about it. I know there's a way. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Becker, followed by John McKenzie.
Good morning, supervisors. My name is Rochelle Becker, and I live in Grover Beach, California. I'm here today to ask you to support AB 1632. In January of this year, this board voted unanimously to send a letter supporting the California Energy Commission's recommendation for cost, benefit, and risk analysis of continued reliance on aging nuclear plants. Assemblyman Blakesley attended the workshops that the Energy Commission put on. He reviewed the recommendations and he wrote, authored, AB 1632. AB 1632 is co-sponsored by representatives from all four reactor communities, Humboldt, San Diego, Sacramento, and San Luis Obispo. It has bipartisan support. It is also supported by the heads of the committees of energy in the Assembly and the Senate. It is supported by the Division of Ratepayer Advocates of the Public Utilities Commission. It is supported by TURN, a consumer advocate organization. It is supported by the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility and the Sierra Club and many others. The bill moved out of committee and goes to appropriations on Monday of next week, and then we'll move through the Senate. We ask you to send a letter of support for Assemblyman Blakesley's bill. It is the next logical step from the letter that you sent in January. We also ask that the county send in a letter to Michael Peavy of the California Public Utilities Commission, who is the president of the commission, asking him to deny PG&E's request for $19 million of ratepayer funding for an in-house feasibility study for license renewal of Diablo Canyon. Until the state has commissioned and undergone and reviewed and analyzed the cost, benefits, and risk of continuing to operate Diablo Canyon, and the county has been involved in that because this county is most affected by whether or not Diablo Canyon continues to operate, it is premature for PG&E to do an in-house study, a license renewal feasibility study. The PUC staff is opposing a license renewal feasibility study as premature. The Sierra Club, TURN, and the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility are also opposing it. We ask that this board send a letter of recommending that denial of this license renewal study as premature in this 2007 general rate case. It is 19 years before the license is termed. It's time for the state to look at the issue and then for PG&E to decide if it's cost-effective for its shareholders. Thank you very much.
Ms. Becker, the letter, does it have to be there before next Monday?
No, it does not. No, it does not. It's just an appropriations. I did bring AB 1632 and sample letters, but I believe those have already been circulated. If they haven't, I'll be glad to send them to everyone. Thank you.
Mr. McKenzie, followed by David Wiseman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Board members, I'm here to just give you a quick update of the San Luis Drainage Beecher reevaluation. Per your board's request from last week, I'm reporting back to you on the actions taken by the Bureau of Reclamation. As you know, the Bureau was supposed to have issued a record of decision yesterday on this project, which would have identified the preferred alternative. And speaking with the Bureau yesterday afternoon, they said they would not be issuing an ROD, but issuing a press release today. Unfortunately, as of 9:05 this morning, they had not done that yet. So I have nothing really to report to you in terms of an action taken by the Bureau. Until such time that a final decision is reached, we will continue to work with County Council and to track this project, continue our efforts in forwarding the county's position to the Bureau to reject the ocean disposal alternative, and update you as new information becomes available. And that concludes my update.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. McKenzie?
Yes, I have one. Well, actually, it's for both Mr. McKenzie and the board. If the press release comes out and we're in session, would it be okay if Mr. McKenzie came and gave us a quick report?
Just be happy to.
Okay. Sure. If you would, please, John. I'm most anxious about this one. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And what we can do, Mr. McKenzie, if you let me know ahead of time in order to give that portion the additional time it needs for board to have a discussion and or have a question comment period. Mr. Wiseman, followed by David Dugan.
Good morning, supervisors. David Wiseman, Morro Bay. Here today, following on with the comments subsequent to those of Ms. Becker's regarding the support for the Assembly Bill 1632, and the at this time denial of. Just make sure that I only have 56 seconds left. Something on.
Good eyes.
Oh, sorry. And getting worse all the time, but I caught that. The aging process continues. Anyway, not to use that time on that. What I'd like to do is follow on to the request for the letter of support and give an indication as to why it might be important for us to take this action now. I moved to California 19 years ago. My parents continue to live on the Jersey Shore where we spent our school years. And coincidentally enough, there happens to be an aging nuclear reactor on the Jersey Shore. In fact, the oldest operating one in the country, which they have applied to relicense. And the people of New Jersey did nothing at first. Now, my parents continue to send me care packages these 19 years since I've been away. Mostly it's coupons for food things I no longer eat and cleaning products I wouldn't use. Yesterday's package included a pair of sneakers, two pairs of slacks, and the following clipping from the Asbury Park Press, which is the hometown newspaper there. It's a Gannett newspaper, and its size and circulation is probably greater than the Tribune and the Sacramento Bee, as their byline here says they are the winner of the Pulitzer Prize. Anyway, this paper has taken quite a stand on this relicensing issue, and my mother thought I might find this interesting. Their editorial begins, "A new chapter in the renewal farce," and this is from their editorial page. "Incredible, simply incredible. A draft report that concludes the Oyster Creek nuclear power plant in Lacey Township would have only a small impact on the environment should the plant's license be renewed for another 20 years relies on data from the 1970s. We would have loved to have new data and information, but it wasn't available," said Jeffrey Ward, the scientist who worked on the ecology section of the report at a hearing on Wednesday. "How about gathering new information, data that would allow researchers to draw valid conclusions? Oh, we forgot. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission doesn't require such studies from plants seeking license renewals." They go on to say, "We're confused about how a license renewal process for an aging plant can exclude so many germane issues, adequacy of evacuation plans, the risk posed by spent fuel pools vulnerable to terrorist attacks, the plant's previous safety record, the competence of management, and the danger posed by on-site storage of spent fuel. If concerns about plant safety don't have residents in a lather, the kangaroo court flavor of the review process should. Public officials and citizens who have been sitting on the sidelines while activists and some state officials have been pushing for an objective analysis of all the risks posed by the plant must get involved. Contact your legislatures, and Governor Corzine insists that your representatives start representing you. Now, this is the op-ed page of the Asbury Park Press. And this is what happens when you don't take a proactive stand to ask the questions that this assembly bill is asking, to ask that the license study be considered premature. What you do is you find your state is behind the curve on this, and once the NRC has stepped in, there's nothing this state can do. Stand at the door and yell. And that's why we have an opportunity to begin asking these questions now and start to figure this stuff with 19 years to go before it's too late. Thank you for your support.
Thank you. Mr. Dugan, followed by Eric Greening.
Good morning. My name is Dave Dugan from Los Osos. Speak on 2701, the Blakesley bill. I am a happy camper today because he says that he will try to get these amendments that Los Osos asked for into the bill. At least he should try, though he is on vacation for a week. The thing that I really was bothered about is that, first of all, the litigation problem, the immunity from litigation. But as well was, there was nothing in there about CEQA, California Environmental Quality Act. That, I believe, if is in there, will help delay some of the angst most people in Los Osos have about this bill. These amendments probably would never have been forwarded if it wasn't for the AB 2701 Citizens Committee, not the LOCSD board. And I can't drive that any harder than to say that it's the citizens that really forward a change in this bill. If these changes are put in place, you will see a lot of opposition to the county taking this project over fall away. And say everybody will. But as it stands, I will try to trust but verify. If these amendments do go through, I will stand down. But until then, I will be ever vigilant so my community can be free of having the wrong project shoved down their throat. Thank you.
Mr. Greening, followed by Lisa Schicker.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Eric Greening. This is very much a seat of the pants public comment, and I certainly appreciate Mr. McKenzie clarifying why until 8:55 I had not been able to find out whether I was going to be giving a very relieved public comment thanking Mr. McKenzie, Mr. Hutchinson, Mr. Oliveira, the Water Resources Advisory Committee, and all of you who've had anything to do with the tremendous relief of knowing they would not choose the ocean as disposal alternative, or, on the other hand, conversely, imploring you to agendize for next week an emergency response, because we only have 30 days to react to the notice of decision and have an EIS to challenge, and et cetera, et cetera. I still don't know which comment will be germane, but I do ask you, please reserve time on next week's agenda so that we can be up with the Brown Act and move if necessary, and thank if we can be relieved. Quite a few other very good comments have been coming forward on other issues, and I'd like to hit on them. One of them is, I very much agree with the speakers who are saying it is extremely timely now to explicitly support Senate Bill 1632, and I would ask that that be on next week's agenda. I also agree with the speakers who are saying we have been cheated of the opportunity to discuss what should or should not be in a wildlife feeding ordinance. I know I came with criticisms of the ordinance as written that was being introduced last week. I still would not want to see that ordinance enacted as such, because I believe we need to separate intent and concentrated feeding as a nuisance from such things as abandoned orchards, which actually form very good habitat, sometimes necessary replacement habitat for other native habitats that have been taken. That said, we need to be able to have that discussion in public. You need to actually have a hearing, and I'm disappointed that we're not having it today, so that we can hone in on what is necessary. I also am very much in support of the issue that Mr. Evans brings up. I have been just disgusted during the heat wave walking down the street and being buffeted by the cold air coming out of buildings to cool the sidewalk for 10 feet. And I think it's up to we as potential customers not to walk into such a building, not to spend money in businesses where the money is being so carelessly wasted. But beyond that, and I know when you talk about the conservation element this afternoon, we're going to be talking about incorporating the energy element and perhaps updating it in certain ways, but we may need to do something in the way of an emergency ordinance before that, because more heat waves, we just can't allow this to happen. And I realize you don't control the urban areas, but we have unincorporated areas that have the same problem.
Mr. Greening, thank you. Ms. Schicker, followed by Marilyn Brown.
Good morning, Board of Supervisors and staff. My name is Lisa Schicker. I'm speaking as an elected official since 2004. And as the president of the Los Osos Community Services District, I have good news for you today. We have a wonderful presentation this Friday, August 4th, at 6 p.m. at the South Bay Community Center, which will unveil the updated wastewater management plan. We're very happy that we'll be able to present this to the community. All of you have received personal invitations, and our citizens are going around the town trying to spread the word about the presentation. And we cordially invite all of you to attend if you can. It's a Friday night, but it's going to be a great presentation. I'd like to segue into many of the comments that you've heard this morning about sustainability, conservation, energy reuse, recycling. I'd like to mention your own integrated regional water management plan, which our plan also segues into. Reading from your own plan, the interregional water management plan must address major water-related objectives, including water supply, groundwater management, ecosystem restoration, and water quality. That's what our project's about. It takes the new research, current approved technologies, and puts them together for a water management plan for Los Osos. Could I put the poster up? How do I? It just places on the screen.
You might want to have it focused. Okay. Ms. Schicker?
Yes.
If you want to go ahead, continue. We have help coming your way.
That's water. It's all about water. The presentation on Friday will include principles of sustainability, resource conservation, water reuse, and integrated water resource management plan. It will have treatment site selection, water supply and demand balance, use of recycled water, collection system alternatives, treatment technologies, energy intensity on alternative systems, estimated costs, and a schedule of implementation. We have quite a bit of detail, and I'm not sure your board has been updated on that, and I wanted to make sure you did know. This is a complete project update for the wastewater project for Los Osos. It's approximately a 200-page report. We'd like to present it to you. If you cannot attend, we'd like to present it to your staff, and looking forward to working with you on this. The Ripley team is well established in California, and they are wastewater engineers and scientists and hydrologists who have designed this plan and presented it. They have experience in conventional technologies of all types and the new technologies that are coming forward that are more efficient. Our issues are sludge, energy, recycling, water, groundwater management, saltwater intrusion. This plan addresses all of those things. The 2001 Environmental Impact Report for the Los Osos project did not have all of the research that has been included since. So we've improved on the project to make it more to more all-encompassing. So anyhow, I'd like you to attend if you can.
Thank
and
you.
I thank you for your time.
Ms. Brown.
Good morning. Good morning, and thank you for letting me present Daphne Fosling's statement. And now, if I could make a short comment of my own.
Ms. Brown, we still need your name for the record.
Oh, Marilyn Brown is my name.
Thank you.
I live in Atascadero. And now, if I could make a short comment of my own. I was very disappointed last week to listen to the erosion of the democratic process by your rejecting the ordinance without a hearing, which your staff had recommended. I think over the last few weeks of reading letters to the editor and the comments given at last week's meeting, it was pretty obvious the ordinance, as written, was not acceptable. It was simply too broad. I think the intent was not clear. The intent is not to punish people. The intent is to protect the wildlife. We are not doing them a favor by intentionally putting out food. Please, give the riders a chance to bring it back in an acceptable form at a public hearing. A hearing can be a good part of the education process, which you have advocated. And now I would like to finish Corina Jones's statement. It's just one paragraph. I would encourage the board to reconsider holding a public hearing with the idea that the language to the proposed ordinance be tightened up. This would quell many concerns, but still address a problem that is sure to get worse with education alone. And I concur wholeheartedly with these statements. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, ma'am. That was the last request to speak. With that, I'll close the public comment period, bring it back to the board members. Start with Supervisor Patterson, followed by Supervisor Bianchi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to take a moment and thank those individuals that spoke this morning regarding the wildlife feeding issue in San Luis Obispo County. I know some came from outside the area to come and share their experience and knowledge with us. It is a very serious problem, but obviously little known to many in San Luis Obispo County, that we do have these human-wildlife conflicts that result not only in human injury, but also in the death of many wildlife species. And spending the past year or so researching this issue and talking primarily with animal advocacy groups as well as animal resource agency individuals like Fish and Game and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as well as Wildlife Services and our own Animal Services Department, they've all collectively said that adopting a local wildlife feeding ordinance will go a long way not only in educating residents about their role in impacting wildlife resources, but also in protecting and reducing human-wildlife conflicts. And it is my hope that we will, in the very near future, bring this issue before the public, before the board, so we can hear all sides of the issue and come to an adequate resolution to the problem of wildlife loss in San Luis Obispo County and also wildlife-human conflicts. And again, thank you all for coming this morning.
Ms. Bianchi?
Yes. I usually don't comment on public comment, but I have lots of comments on this public comment. So relative to the wildlife feeding ordinance, the Fish and Game section, if anybody wants to write it down, is 251.1 point. And the language in the Fish and Wildlife State Code, which prohibits prohibits the harassment of animals and defines harassment as anything that alters the normal behavior of wildlife. I've written it so many times I have it memorized. Prohibits the altering the behavior of normal behavior of wildlife through three things, but one of them is feeding, and that's the end of that sentence. But the language in that code is better than what we would have had in the ordinance. And I didn't know about the code until after the meeting was over with, or I would have brought it up last week. The thing in the ordinance that bothered me was the fact that it referred to an attractant. Well, as I tried to indicate last week, almost anything can be an attractant for wildlife. But it's the normal behavior, for example, for a deer to come into your yard and eat your roses. You know, they do that just... they have a wonderful time, and you're not attracting them by doing that, but you do attract them, for instance, by putting out a salt lick or feeding or whatever. Now, that is in violation of the state code. So I've been working with some of our other staff in the agricultural area on a method to try to incorporate this as well into the educational process, that if you put out, if you deliberately put out food or wildlife, it's in violation of state code. And people need to understand that. It's not just somebody's whim. So that's the end of that. So then we get into Pete Evans' suggestion relative to what we can do on the businesses that don't close their doors during a statewide alert. And I believe that some of the cities were distressed about this as well. And I would, I don't know how we can do this, just direct staff, I guess, on a consensus to work with the cities to come up with a solution to this problem. Because when people are dying in the state because of a lack of energy, I think it's, and the word totally inappropriate is not strong enough, but it's totally inappropriate for the businesses to keep their doors open so they don't lose money when other people are losing their lives. And relative to AB 1632, I would like this to come back for the board as a suggestion for a letter, direct staff to bring it back with a letter on the closest appropriate agenda for possible support of AB 1632.
Just for your information, Ms. Bianchi, I have a discussion with Mr. Age, and we're in the process of bringing maybe not the exact letter, but a letter that then the board can decide. But I have not gone beyond Mr. Edge in the. I just don't want to violate Brown Act violation and have Colin speak to you individually about supporting a letter. I want to go through the administration and be sure that it's handled properly and comes to your attention.
But I have one more.
But Ms. Becker is welcome to give and lobby the rest of us on her own time, and that does those violation does not allow.
Okay, and
apply to you. So.
One,
but
one
it is in the process.
Okay. Well, and thank you very much. I appreciate that. One last item. I keep hearing that there's a problem in Los Osos with the county not following the California Environmental Quality Act. We always attempt as much as possible to follow the California Environmental Quality Act. After all, it too is state law. And I don't know where that rumor got started, but it's, you know, that's all it is a baseless rumor. So I think that ends my comments.
Thank you, ma'am. And that ends everybody else's comments. With that, we move forward the rest of our agenda. Prior to do that, I would like to recognize in the audience our former 4th District Supervisor, Ms. Brackett. Welcome. Okay, with consent agenda items, I don't have any request to speak. So if anybody wishes to speak, please come forward with your request and or come to the podium. Be ready to give us your name and your name for the record. Mr. Kovacs, so far you're it, if you want to start, sir.
Thank you. I'm Michael Kovacs, one of the citizens for honest representations from District number 5. I'd like to talk about consent agenda item B3, 11, and 13. These are all, each and every one of them are contract amendments for various services by vendors, contractors, chosen usually for being the lowest bidders. Now, after they got the contract based on being the lowest bidders, they just submit requests for amendments. I have never remembered that your board disapproved any of these amendments. Did or does anybody look closely into these? I have been in the defense industry contracts and finance for decades. for multi-hundred, multi-10 million dollars, sometimes $100 million contracts were given based on the lowest bidder, and later on they came back multiple million dollars amendments. We investigated them and disapproved those amendments that were clearly underbidded in order to get the business. Too many of these amendments are submitted to you for your approval. Did anybody of you, board members, or the internal audit, by the way, we have seven, or I don't know how many auditors, did they investigate and examine these amendments? I urge your board to pay attention to these for the benefit of the public.
Anyone else? Seeing none, close it to the public at this time. Bring it back to the board members. Ms. Bianchi, any items to discuss or pull for separate vote?
None, thank you.
Mr. Lentil?
No, sir.
Mr. Patterson?
No, sir.
Mr. Robit?
No.
Motion to approve?
So moved.
Second.
Moved by Supervisor Lentil, seconded by Supervisor Bianchi. Roll call, please.
Mr. Lentil?
Aye.
Ms. Bianchi?
Yes.
Mr. Ovid?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Shajian?
Aye. With that, we'll go on a very short break for 15 minutes, and we should be back here at 10:23. Would you please pass this forward? Next item.
Yep. How are you, John?
Fine, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I thought Gary was going to be late.
I couldn't remember what time he said. He was just saying that we were all paying attention by saying
10:23, it's 10:24. Okay, with that, if Madam Clerk will introduce the first item, please.
Your first hearing item this morning is item C1. This is a hearing to consider the formation of zone of benefit and a request to call a special tax election in Cimarron Way Road Improvement Zone of County Service Area Number 9, located in Los Osos, Baywood Park, 2nd District. Recommendation is for approval and instruct the chairperson to sign. And as a reminder, your board had a correction to this morning's agenda where the second resolution was added.
Thank you. Would that be John Waddell, or?
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board. I'm John Waddell with the Public Works Department.
This is one of our typical cooperative road projects. We received a request from the property owners to pave a portion of Cimarron Way in Los Osos. We subsequently surveyed the property owners on the street that were affected. There are 8 properties. We sent out surveys proposing that we pave 200 feet of the road and divide the cost evenly among the 8 properties. Of the 8 surveys mailed in March, there were 3 in favor, 0 opposed, and 5 did not respond. We've now moved forward to the election process required under Proposition 218. The resolutions before you today would create a special tax zone and set a special mail ballot election for November 5th for the voters in this zone. The successful election would allow the road to be paved, most likely sometime within 6 months of the election.
Does that conclude your reporting? Okay, any questions?
None.
And at this time, we'll go to the public. First request to speak is Jennifer McCallum, followed by Jim and or Linda Mahaffey. Okay. Please,
Jennifer McCallum, and the project is about paving 200 feet of Cimarron. Some of the benefits of the project are we'll be able to get the mail delivered on Cimarron. One of the problems has been that getting the mail, we have to get onto Los Osos Valley Road, drive a little bit, make a left turn, drive down another street, and get the mail, get back on, make another left turn, and drive down Cimarron. And the mail out there has been stolen routinely. There are people who have had to get a P.O. box because of that. And for years, I've asked the post office if we could have the mailboxes moved to Cimarron. And finally, this year, the new postmaster has agreed, and with the caveat that the road be paved. And he allowed us to already move the mailboxes over there to Cimarron, and we can now get the mail by walking. And it's in front of a house, so the mail is more protected. And one of the reasons about the road being paved there is a very bad section of road. The water comes off of one property in the wintertime. It crosses Cimarron and meets with a berm that the receiving property has. So the water stays on Cimarron, makes a big mess there, big holes and ruts, and it's a really bad section. Another benefit is that leaving Cimarron, the rear wheels are on dirt. The person has to accelerate to get onto Los Osos Valley Road, which is pavement, and going from dirt to pavement causes tires to spin out and dust and erosion. So these are a few of the benefits of having that very small section of the road paved. Thank you.
Thank you.
This may not be the forum.
Please give us your name for the record, and you can pull that forward to make it easier for us.
I'm Linda Mahaffey, and this may not be the forum to ask the questions, but we couldn't find out any other way. We are in favor of this. However, we wanted to go further. We were willing to find out about paving at our expense from this 200 past our property, which would be an additional 600 to 700 feet. We can't find out if that's permissible. We would have to get the specs from the county to do that. And when we called asphalt companies to solicit this information and read the first letter, the first comment was to laugh at us for the cost. They wanted to know, was the 200 feet being paved in gold? And we had no comment because we don't know. They also said if we had the specs issued by the county, they could give us a bid. But until that time, they won't even talk to us in a ballpark. So that's what we'd like to know, is if you can't answer us, or even in a letter, as to where these specs came from of $240 per linear square per linear foot at 200 feet, we wanted to know where that cost came from.
Okay, let's give it a try. But let's give it a try to get you some answers, but after you're done, are you done?
I believe so.
Okay, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Mahaffey.
I think you're in luck because this gentleman in the green T-shirt right there, Mr. George Gibson, will answer your questions.
Well, the other one about the cost was we plan to pay for it up front.
Well, he can answer all of your questions.
We are the second oldest people on the whole road, so therefore 10 years at 775 a year at 9% interest is unacceptable to us, but we will pay it up front. But if he can answer...
Yeah, if when this item is over with, if you could talk with Mr. Gibson out in the... And he will be able to discuss it with you. Thank you.
As long as it's up to the county spec and they're willing to pay, I don't see a problem myself here. But as Ms. Bianchi recommended, if you get together with Mr. Gibson, he has the answers. Mr. Waddell, anything else to add?
I was just waiting to answer a question, if she had questions.
Go ahead if you want to respond now.
Okay.
With that, that was the last request to speak. Bring it back to the board.
I would move staff's recommendation with the replacement of the resolution that's in the staff report with the resolution in the addendum and waive a reading of that.
Second.
And that's actually two resolutions.
Two resolutions.
Correct. Okay.
Then I don't want to replace it. I want to add it.
Moved by Supervisor Bianchi, seconded by Supervisor Lentol. A roll call, please.
Mrs. Bianchi?
Yes.
Mr. Lentol?
Aye.
Mr. Ovitt?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Shahjian?
Aye. Mr. Ovitt has a request.
Yeah. I'm going to wait to see what Mr. Franis say, but we did have a letter on item C2. They were doing some checking on that, and my request was to move C2 after item C3. Be all right?
Yes.
Okay, Mr. Okay. Chairman, I would ask that we take item C3 and then item C2.
Okay. If there are no objections from board members, we'll do accordingly. We'll go to C3 if Madam Clerk will introduce that item, please.
Thanks. Next item is item C3. This is a hearing to consider an appeal by Kathy McGregor of a decision of the Planning Commission disapproving minor use permit DRC 2003-00043 for a winery building including wine processing, barrel storage, and tasting room. The project is located at 1600 Old Price Canyon Road, approximately 2.5 miles south of the city of San Luis Obispo in the 3rd District. This item was continued from June 6, 2006. Recommendations for approval.
Thank you. Mr. Duarte?
Good morning. Brian Pedrotti, staff planner. The project before you is a continued hearing to consider an appeal by Kathy McGregor of the Planning Commission's disapproval of a minor use permit application for a winery building, including wine processing, barrel storage, and a tasting room. The Planning Commission denied the request on August 11, 2005, and the Board of Supervisors upheld the appeal and continued the item on March 21, 2006 and June 6, 2006 to allow time to complete the environmental determination. Staff has completed the environmental determination for the project per the direction of the Board and has issued a negative declaration for the project. Now, the site is located at the northwest corner of Price Canyon and Edna Road, south of Old Price Canyon Road, and 2.5 miles south of the city of San Luis Obispo. Project is in the agricultural land use category. It borders the Los Ranchos and the village area to the north and is surrounded by agriculture on three sides. There's an existing vineyard on the site, as well as a rocky outcrop, rock hill, and the proposed location of the building is at the top of that rock hill. Here's another site. The proposal is for a 2,000 square foot winery with processing area and a 400 square foot tasting room, as well as driveway access to the site and parking areas. The building elevations are of a rural type with metal roofing and some trellis and awning elements. The site includes a landscaping plan to screen and break up the building from various public views. And staff has recommended that the board adopt the resolution reversing this decision of the Planning Commission and conditionally approving the application of Kathy McGregor for the minor use permit, DRC 2003-00043. In addition, you have before you a memo from staff suggesting a few minor revisions to the conditions of approval. The first one, actually the first two, condition 1B and condition 31, relate to the maximum height, and the maximum height as shown on the elevations that were before your board earlier were at 30 feet. And it was at various heights throughout the conditions, but those have been changed to 30 feet. In addition, condition number 40, which is the indemnification clause, the indemnification clause that was in the conditions was regarding subdivisions, and that has been changed to reflect that this is a minor use permit. Staff would also like to read a couple additional catches of the staff report that we'd like to read into the record. The first is on page C38, under the approved development condition 1, under the approval of what it authorizes, under 1A, the end of the first sentence talks about an outdoor processing area partially covered by an awning vine, or awning wine, actually. Makes no sense at all, and so we would eliminate the word wine. The additional change would be condition number 34 under environmental mitigations, and this talks about monitoring mitigation activities and consulting an archaeologist. This was a carryover from a previous report, and it's actually not a mitigation measure that was noted in the negative declaration. They did do a phase one archaeology survey and found that no evidence of resources on the site. So it was no mitigation proposed by the negative declaration. And that concludes staff's presentation.
So do we delete number 34?
Yes, delete number 34.
Thank you. With that, any questions or comments from supervisors? Seeing none, this is an appeal. Ms. Kirk, are you representing the applicant?
I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jamie Kirk.
Let me say that since this is the second time we're here, we're going to give you 5 minutes, and we'll give you a chance to rebuttal at the end if there are any other comments.
I think I only need two. We don't have a prepared presentation this morning. You've seen the project a couple times, and the only thing that has really happened since the last hearing was staff went through the environmental determination. This supplemental information that we provided was a biological report for the site, and it did indicate that there were no rare sensitive species on the site. There was one mitigation measure that came out of that, and that had to do with nesting birds, and that mitigation was carried through as a mitigation measure as well as a condition of approval. One other item I would like to point out on the staff report would be on page 4, item C3, under environmental health, it talked about concerns about placement of on-site septic system with the steep slopes. They do not support the proposal. That was based on the original design and not on the revised design that showed the wastewater system under 30% slope. So I just wanted to make sure that that was clear in the record this morning. And that concludes my comments. We'd like to thank staff for their efforts to this time, and we'd really appreciate your support this afternoon.
Thank you. With that, I don't see any other public request to comment on this item. Another 30 seconds, Ms. Kirk?
No, thank you.
You're welcome. That will bring it back to the board. Mr. Lentil?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jamie, while you are sitting down, I think it's appropriate also to thank you and Mrs. McGregor. This has been a long project, over a year's worth of work, and I appreciate all you've done to work with county staff. On that, I make a motion to approve staff's recommendation.
Second.
Are you reading?
With
the attachment.
That's
sure will be changed.
Are we clear on the changes?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. With that, moved by Supervisor Lentil, seconded by Supervisor Ovid. A roll call, please.
Mr. Lentil?
Aye.
Mr. Ovid?
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi?
No.
Mr. Patterson?
No.
Mr. Shajian?
Aye. With that, we'll move to item C2.
Okay.
Are we ready, Mr. Ovitz, on that?
Yes, thank you.
Next item on your agenda is item C2. This is a hearing to consider an ordinance imposing a moratorium of, is that the right one? Of issuing the will serve letters outside the boundaries of CSA 7, Zone A, First District. This item was introduced on July 25th, 2006. Recommendation is for approval and instruct the chairperson to sign.
Mr. Benedict?
Good morning. Is your, I don't think the light is on at the base of your.
There you go.
Yeah.
Good morning, Honorable Chairman Nasajian and members of the board. I am Dean Benedict, Public Works Utilities Manager. And as the. As the clerk read, there's two actions in this item this morning. The first is to conduct a public hearing for imposing a moratorium on the issuing of sanitary sewer will serve letters for areas outside the boundaries of CSA 7, Zone A, and secondly, to approve the ordinance imposing the moratorium. I have an exhibit here I would like to refer to, give you a basic layout of the area here. That comes up on the screen. CSA 7 is the outermost line. Lake Nacimiento is right here. This is on the north side of Lake Nacimiento. CSA 7 is the main area. Let me describe that a little bit. CSA 7 was formed in 1967 to provide special district services to the Oak Shores community on the north shore of Lake Nacimiento. CSA 7 Zone A. Zone A is the Oak Shores development as we know it today, which is within this area. It was formed in 1976 for the specific service of collecting, treating, operating, and maintaining a sanitary sewer system. The existing wastewater system for CSA 7A is not currently adequate to provide service to additional areas outside of CSA 7A. You see there's the area map here shows area CSA 7. There's a lot of perimeter areas outside of 7A within here. Improvements and modifications to the existing CSA 7 wastewater treatment and disposal system are necessary to provide any service outside of CSA 7A. Thirdly, CSA 7 Zone C was formed last Tuesday, July 25th, for the purpose of providing sanitary sewer to the track 2162 area. This is the area to the southeast adjacent to the Oak Shores area. CSA 7 Zone C only encompasses track 2162 phases 2 through 6, and it was formed to assure that appropriate funding by new development was provided, since there's not capacity with the current system to provide outside development. The basis for our recommendation today to impose a moratorium outside of CSA 7A is that the county is unable to provide will serve letters for that territory at this time. This action will formalize the fact that CSA 7 cannot provide service to track 2162, which is a condition of approval of that tract. It will also enable track 2162 to obtain a stay of expiration of the map. The map will expire next month unless this action is taken. In concert with these actions, the staff is doing a couple of items. We have submitted an amended request of waste discharge to the Regional Water Quality Control Board, requesting a review of increase in treatment and disposal capacity based on an engineering analysis that has been done. We anticipate that evaluation and issuance of an amended permit will take approximately 9 months. And the regional board has in writing advised us that they see a general benefit of improvements that have been recommended for the overall system. We are also preparing a recommendation that we'll bring back to your board in the future to issue a conditional will serve letter for development within CSA 7C for track 2162. These will include recommendations or conditions under which we recommend the moratorium be lifted. In conclusion, imposing the moratorium will formalize the current status of the system's limited capacity to serve only CSA 7A Oak Shores area. It will also allow CSA 7C, which is Track 2162, Phases 2 through 6, to develop the necessary infrastructure plans for the expansion and betterment of CSA 7 wastewater system facilities. And that concludes my staff report.
Thank you. Mr. Ovid?
Yeah, Dean, while you're at it, this goes farther than just 7C. Actually, this is part of a whole project we've been working on. Maybe you want to explain so that we can cover all the areas in Oak Shores.
Yes. The areas that are outside of 7A, within CSA 7, there are several developers, landowners who are interested in developing their property. We have met with several of them for several times, 6 months to a year or so ago. Track 2162, developers have sort of taken the ball and done the initial engineering phase to see what needed to be done. That's why we have submitted an amendment to the board, and we are looking at a master plan sort of this. So this action sort of, as I said, it formalizes that we cannot serve anyone outside CSA currently, but it also sort of has taken the step consistent with engineering analysis that there will be future development and future improvements to expand that as necessary and appropriate.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Seeing none, we'll go to the public. First speaker is Tom Wylett, followed by David Watson.
Good morning. Tom Willett, Adam Skomorowski, Madden, and Green on behalf of two of the interested landowners in the area. We submitted a letter earlier this morning based on the fact that we had no notice of the proposed action until literally yesterday afternoon. Since that time, we've had a chance to speak with staff and council, and based on that, based on our understanding that there will be more of an effort to work with the other landowners as well. I think my understanding is there were earlier discussions, but again, we had no notice that this action was going to be taking place. But based on those discussions, we're going to be withdrawing our letter and our objection.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Watson?
Good morning, Supervisors. My name is Dave Watson. I'm here on behalf of the developers of Track 2162 at Oak Shores. Thank you for the opportunity to speak briefly. We're here in support of the staff's recommendation. As is pointed out by Mr. Benedict, we have been working really for a couple of years now on the development of the track, and one of the things that we're very diligently involved with is providing engineering solutions to address the comprehensive service requirements of CSA 7 when it comes to wastewater treatment and disposal. The process that we've gone through so far has involved about a year's worth of time. We've developed a series of options, one of which has been preferred by staff as the appropriate way to upgrade and expand the plant for existing efficiencies and for future development. Our track will be fronting the costs of all engineering work and processing through the permitting phase of this with Regional Water. Once completed with Regional Water, we hope to have a phased development plan for improvements to the site that we will initiate with our project that will benefit existing Oak Shores residents in the short term, as well as provide for long-term expansion of the system to meet the entire service area demands of CSA 7. From our perspective, this is a good long-range thinking way to create efficiencies now and to provide for the orderly development and the proper disposal of wastewater for the long term. So we appreciate the efforts of staff. The moratorium provides us time as it relates to our tract to continue to facilitate these efforts and then in a timely and practical way implement the solutions once the county agrees to them. So again, I'm here to answer any questions. We're here in support of staff and appreciate your consideration today.
Thank you. Please, before you leave, Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Watson, will the upgrades to the existing treatment facility, will they be phased in or will that be done all at once?
I'm sure it will be done in phases. As you can appreciate, the effort for the last year has been in conceptualizing the right series of improvements to create for CSA 7. And as we move forward with the initial phase one improvements for our project, there will be improvements both specific to our tracks and then ultimately for future connections and efficiencies within the total system. So there will be treatment and disposal improvements that we will initiate with our first project, some of which will be for the benefit of later developers, later residents of 7A. So it isn't precisely just what we need. We'll do something for us as well as expand it beyond that and then provide for future improvements as conditions warrant. So it's a puzzle-making process that will work everybody's benefit down there.
Do you have an estimate of how much development will occur out there, what the ultimate build-out is, and over what period of time?
I think for the staff, I think they have a better handle on that. Generally speaking, our project represents about 345 or so units in total. 60 of those are already in 7A, 285 or so are left to go. I believe there's about 200 to 300 units of density to be constructed within existing Oak Shores as well. So the existing subdivisions that are part of 7A have a certain level of development still to be achieved. And then I think the build-out of entire CSA 7 would require some of the other sites that have been referred to come in with applications and proceed. But I think Mr. Benedict has probably more accurate numbers than I have.
We can also add to the fact that what you're looking at is a master plan community, and there are three sections of development. You had what was called the central, which is now the Oak Shores as it is today, which is some of 7A, the west or the east side, which is the 2162, which you're talking about. And we also have people that we're dealing with on what's called the west development for toll development. Plus, there's some fringe areas now that are looking to add in. And again, working with the developers, the landowners, staff, and Oak Shores itself, we've recognized what that potential is and where we need sites for the expansion. And that's all part of this whole process we're doing right now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think it's like 1,700 units, is it, Dean?
Yes, it's 1,713 units is it.
Total, yeah. Total build-out.
That was the last request to speak. Bring it back to the board. Supervisor Ovid, do you have a motion?
Yes, sir. And again, I think it would be appropriate to thank those people that are investing in on this on the 2162. And it would be my privilege to make the motion to approve the attached ordinance improving the moratorium issuing, well, serves out seven, CSA 7, Zone A, and waive reading.
Second.
Moved by Supervisor Ovid, seconded by Supervisor Bianchi. Roll call, please.
Mr. Ovid?
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi?
Yes.
Mr. Lindthal?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Shajian?
Aye. Next item, please.
Next item is item C4. This is a hearing to consider a resolution of necessity for the San Luis Obispo County Regional Airport Runway 1129 extension project, including land for temporary construction easement in the 3rd District. This item was continued from July 25, 2006. Recommendations for approval. Instruct the chairperson to sign.
Chairman Bajan, members of the board, I'm Dwayne Live, General Services Director. I'm here to open the hearing and tell you that we don't need to have the hearing. An agreement has been reached. It's called a bridging agreement, which I believe your board will get the details about shortly in closed session. But we would recommend that you close the hearing as no further action is required at this time.
Is it withdraw?
Sorry?
Except to withdraw then.
Yes. Withdraw.
Okay.
Thank you.
So we're not going to have a hearing to have a hearing.
Okay.
Okay, with that, I'll open it to the public for any comments. Seeing no comments from the public, bring it back to Supervisor Lindthal.
Move staff recommendation.
Second.
Moved by Supervisor Lindthal, seconded by Supervisor Patterson. Roll call, please.
Mr. Lindthal?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Ovid?
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi?
Yes.
Mr. Shajian?
Aye. At this time for the next item, we're going to adjourn as the Board of Supervisors and reconvene as the In-Home Support Services Public Authority Governing Board. With that, if you'll do an introduction.
Yeah, you know, your item's not until this afternoon. So I'm sorry.
Oh. Sorry, Cammy. See you, too.
No. Your next item on your agenda is actually you're now sitting as the IHSS Public Authority Governing Board, and your first item under that is for public comment.
Okay, I don't have any request from the public, but if you wish to comment, please come forward and give us your name for the record. No comment from the public? Okay. Next, Madam Clerk.
Sorry. Your next item is election of officers for chairman and for secretary.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Mr. Lindholm is going to speak up. We discussed this yesterday, okay?
Yes, I believe that the only election that you're required to have is of chairman. Bylaws, and as far as we can tell, anything else don't require that you elect a secretary. Of course, if you'd like to do so, you can. But I think that you have a secretary, and it's not necessary to elect her. So the only item that you have to act on with respect to election of officers is the chairman.
I nominate chairman.
Well, Mr. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, go ahead, Ms. Bianchi.
I nominate Katja Rashadrian as chair.
A second.
We have a motion by Supervisor Bianchi, second by Supervisor Patterson. Under discussion, Mr. Robit.
We're not going to approve the bylaws until afterwards, and item section 2 puts the fiscal year starting in July and ending the last of June. Yet, if we follow through with this to use the chairman is usually established in
January.
In the calendar year, in January. I have no problem with it now, but can we then make a motion to change the bylaws?
To go from January.
Correspond with the chairman of the board, and we'll do that at the approval. Thank you.
Okay, let's take care of the first motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it. Mr. Robit?
Then I think that on the next item, which is review and approve the minutes, I would approve the bylaws with reference to section 4.2, elections of officers, which reverts to section 2.2, and that the board shall organize and operate on a annual year starting with the first regular business meeting in January. And ending in the last day of December, corresponding with the reorganization of the Board of Supervisors.
Second.
And I guess that language could be cleaned up a little better, or I'm looking at Mr. Lindholm to see if that's acceptable.
I think it's pretty well washed right now, and we should go with it.
Okay. That would be my motion, sir.
Okay. Was moved by Supervisor Roberts, seconded by Supervisor Bianchi. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Any opposed? Ayes have it. Madam Clerk.
Your next item is review and approval of contract for services operating agreement between the San Luis Obispo County IHSS Public Authority and the County of San Luis Obispo Welfare and Institutions Code Section 12301.6, subsection B, subsection 2.
Just for clarification, we asked for public comment. Do we need to ask one for every item? Or
I would think that you would treat this like you would any item on the agenda, and each item should be discussed.
Okay.
Open.
Well, next item in front of us, any public comment? Seeing none, bring it back to the board for motion or discussion.
Mr. Chairman, I would move for the recommendation.
Second.
Moved by Supervisor Obit, seconded by Supervisor Bianchi. Under discussion, Supervisor Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question for Mr. Collins, and that is the status of the advisory committee. Has that process begun, or what are the plans for that?
Yes, thank you, Lee Collins, representing the Department of Social Services. The recruitment is underway, and we are aware that some individuals have expressed an interest, and we will be contacting them and making sure that your board is aware when that begins of all the information that's available. We expect that there will be some transition from the prior governing board into the new advisory board, as well as new members.
Thank you.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it. Anything further, Madam Clerk?
The next two are just informational items. That update on employer-employee relations policy revision process and the update on the IHSS caregiver health insurance.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members, very briefly, there will be an employer-employee relations policy. This is subject to meet and confer. Currently, negotiations are going on with the union, not around this issue, however, around wages and compensation. We will be in contact with them proposing and negotiating any adjustments to the employer-employee relations policy that we've already sort of drawn up in draft. And we'll be getting back to you on that for your final approval at a later meeting. Also, in terms of the caregiver's health insurance program, that those payments are continuing as is. This is fairly standard operating procedure at the expiration of a contract. We are continuing the full benefit package as negotiations for a new package are still underway and until they conclude.
Okay. Does this require our... Is it just received and filed, and when you have it in place, does it come back to us? Or
there, upon the conclusion of negotiations, there will be ratification procedures both by the union and by the governing board to approve whatever that tentative agreement is.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Collins.
Thank you.
Anything else, Madam Clerk? Okay, then at this time we'll adjourn as the In-Home Support Service Public Authority Governing Board and reconvene as a Board of Supervisors. With that, Mr. Lindholm, any items for closed session?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The board is about to go into closed session, and as it turns out, we're only going to meet on one item, and that is the CBNI matter. And we will be in closed session for less than 20 minutes.
Thank you. Does anyone from the public wishes to comment on closed session items? Seeing none, we'll disarm adjourn to closed session and reconvene at 2 p.m. Thank you.
we're going to have a cat fight before the day is over. She's going to go over and scratch Harry's eye out.
I don't think you would.
Yep. Hey, Harry. I only have $20 in my pocket, but I'm betting on Vicky.
Boy, that'd be a no-brainer.
I've seen her in action.
No, we're not.
No, he's on. He's good to go.
That's it. Don't mess with the clerk.
Green light is on.
Green light.
Okay.
No, we're good.
Takes a little longer to warm up. Thank you. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, for our afternoon August 1st meeting. Mr. Lindholm, anything to report from the closed session?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The board met in closed session on one item, real estate negotiations, took no final action, and therefore no public report is required, and that's today's public report.
Thank you. Thank you. Very well done.
And you were right. It was less than 20 minutes.
Okay. I had it memorized and to say it if you didn't show up. With that, Madam Clerk, you'll introduce the next item, please.
Your next item on today's agenda is item C5. This is a hearing to consider an appeal by Nathan and April Vasquez of the denial of the curb gutter and sidewalk waiver, request DRC 2005-00192, located at 1343 L Street in the community of San Miguel, 1st District. This item was continued from July 25, 2006. Recommendation is approval of the appeal.
Thank you. Ms. Cavanaugh.
Good afternoon, Elizabeth Cavanaugh, County Planning Staff. I'm here and I returned with a resolution and findings for approval of the waiver request for the curb gutter and sidewalk that you heard last week, and I'll be available for any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Any public wishes to comment on this item? Seeing none, bring it back to Mr. Ovid.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move for staff recommendation.
Second.
Moved by Supervisor Ovid, seconded by Ms. Bianchi. Roll call, please.
Mr. Ovid?
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi?
Yes.
Mr. Lindholm?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Shajian?
Aye. Next item, please.
Next item on your agenda is item D1. This is submittal of a request for authorization of a general plan amendment to revise the conservation element of the general plan.
Thank you. And would that be...
Mr. Caruso. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, James Caruso, Department of Planning and Building. This is an authorization request from the department. We request your board's authorization to start the update process of the conservation elements. The conservation elements of the general plan, I'm going to give you a little background on the general plan. If you were applying to our department as a planner one, you'd have to know all this, so let's go through it real fast. There are 7 mandatory elements of the general plan. Oh, I changed the slide so I can't test you on this. But land use, open space, safety, conservation, circulation, housing, and noise are the 7 mandatory elements of the general plan. State of California requires each of the 500 plus cities and counties in California to maintain a general plan with these 7 elements. This county is no different. We have all 7 of these elements. In addition to those elements of the general plan, the state allows you to have what are called optional elements. This county has 4 optional elements. We have an agriculture element, an award-winning energy element, an offshore energy element, and a parks and recreation element that, as your board knows, is in hearing process right now at the Planning Commission and will be coming to your board soon. Of those 7 mandatory elements, the conservation element is described as being natural resource based. The state general plan guidelines also tells us that it often overlaps other elements with policies and goals that are taken from other elements of the general plan. It also says it has a more of a technical orientation than the other elements of the general plan, sort of on par with circulation. And one of the interesting things that we've discovered in our research is that the conservation element is often consolidated with other elements of the general plan, which we're going to be talking about in just a minute. So what kind of areas of the conservation element get into? in our research, we've looked at a lot of different counties and cities, and here are the these are typical, what we call topical areas that are found in a general plan. And as you notice, they are natural, they're resource-based. There's visual and cultural resources, which this county is, of course, replete with. Sustainable development, biological resources are included. Air quality, energy, soils, solid waste and recycling, which is interesting in that we found a few counties that include solid waste and recycling as resources. If your board, I think it was just Supervisor Ovitt, might have remembered the siting element, trying to find the sites for new landfills in the late 80s, early 90s, which is almost impossible now. Still trying to find, see, after 20 years.
It's not that we don't have memories, good memories, but that he was the only one
around. That's right.
Hey, I was on the old garbage board.
Garbage board.
That's when they called it garbage. That's how
yes, how long ago?
It's not a garbage element. It's a solid waste element. Thank you.
You still call it trailers.
Mm-hmm. Oh, which?
Trailers.
Ah, okay. And I was going to say we have it. We have it.
And perhaps the most important resource, seeing how this is California, is water. Matter of fact, the water issue, water resources, is what started the update process of this conservation element when your board was considering the necessity of preparing a water element to the general plan. It was decided to update the conservation element and include water as one of those important resources to be considered. We have broken down the work plan into five basic steps. And I added the first step. I'm calling the first step initiation of the program, which we are doing as of today. We have a task list together that has about, right now, a dozen different tasks just for number one, which is initiating the program. Identifying the vision of the plan, which is probably one of the most important parts of updating a general plan element, is to create a vision of where you're going, what are you trying to do, the issues that come out of that, and then instead of calling them problems, we call them opportunities. So we're going to identify the vision, the issues, and the opportunities that are before us in consideration of the conservation element update. Once we do that, we'll be able to prepare a draft plan with draft policies, goals, and objectives. The CEQA process can never be put aside, of course. We're going to have to either prepare an EIR or a negative DEC. That decision will be made while that draft plan is in process, and we have some cutting-edge ideas of on how to include the CEQA process in our update. And then hearings before the Planning Commission and your board. One of the things that we're already starting on and will be part of the real interesting part of this is looking into consolidating elements of the general plan. As I stated before, many counties and cities already consolidate the conservation and open space requirements in one general plan element. The one closest to home is the city of San Luis Obispo. Just this year, was it 2006, I think, just adopted a new COS, a conservation and open space element to their general plan. So we're taking a close look at that to see if it's might have an opportunity to do that. The other resources that we are going to investigate consolidating into the general plan are agriculture, energy, and offshore energy. I'm not exactly sure how this is going to turn out, but as I said, this might become one of the more important aspects of the work plan. One of the things the state tells us is that consolidating your general plan elements is most helpful in ensuring what is called internal consistency. So remember, every policy and every goal of every element of your general plan has to be consistent with all the other elements of the general plan. It's easier to do that when you have consolidated those like elements. We will involve the community advisory councils in this update process. We've identified a minimum of four places where advisory councils will be brought information and will be given an opportunity for comment. Right now at project commencement, let's say in the next 60 days or so, when a draft plan is available for review during the early part of the CEQA process, and of course at the end of the draft EIR process when we have a public review draft of the EIR. There are other opportunities for CAC review and involvement, but these are the four primary places that we know we can involve them and make sure we bring the correct information to them. This is my personal favorite. As much as we don't want to commit to this, we are going to. People say that it's impossible to do a major plan update in 3 years, or 36 months, put it another way. Staff is going to show that it is possible to do a major general plan element update in 3 years. So on August 1st of 2009, we will be back before your board with a conservation element to be adopted. And if we're not, I'm sure Mr. Hollanda will fire me.
He will certainly remind you.
Remind me. That's right. That's what I meant to say. It was remind me.
Get that in your notebook, Mr. Hollanda.
And there are actually ways of that we can do this. The state guidelines, once again, tell us two things. How do you streamline this process? First and foremost is you have to have an efficient review process and hearing process. And when I say efficient review process, I'll be frank with you. It's going to be a rigorously enforced review process. Often what happens, not only on plan updates, but also with project review, is people, organizations, agencies get 3, 4, 5, 6 bites of the apple, all taking 2 to 3 months each bite. As you can see, that widens your time frame, and plans hang on for years. We are going to have to ensure that everyone gets one bite of the apple at the appropriate time. If you miss your bite, well, you're going to have to move on. We will move on to the next step. Also, the hearing process is going to have to be streamlined. The second way of streamlining the process is through the CEQA process. Almost all the time, you'll see a plan development and CEQA done in a linear fashion or consecutive fashion. You prepare your draft plan, then you're ready for a notice of preparation and, say, an EIR if you go down that EIR road. There are ways, although the state is pretty mysterious about it because I don't think they really know how to do this, but there are ways of melding the CEQA process into the update process. Mr. Stevenson and I, Mr. Stevenson is the boss, of course, and of the long-range planning division, and we have some very definite ideas on how we can create what we are going to call a self-mitigating document. And we hope that this creates real time efficiencies and will allow us to meet our goal of a 36-month process. We are designing the public outreach program right now. We are designing our web-based newsletter that will inform the public and anyone interested in the conservation element of the newest information available, where we're going, where we've been, where the next events are, where the next meetings are. One of the things that we hope happens and one of our goals are is at the end of this process, no one says they did not have adequate information or they did not have adequate time or opportunity to review the information that's available. We'll be also emphasizing a community outreach program with scoping meetings, opinion surveys, with the help of some consultants. So where are we? Well, we've got the website up and running. That's part of the Department of Planning and Building website. I hope we have that up and running as of today, because I have it up on the screen. We're in the midst of reaching out for some consultant assistance in our first phase, our first task list. We are already identifying stakeholders and experts who can help us with formulating the draft plan. We have Eric, our intern, is already hard at work on his consolidation research, and we're also working on some details of the schedule. So we working backward from April 1st, 2009. We will know exactly where we need to be every month in order to keep on this this rigorous schedule. So the department is looking forward to this. We hope it to be a model of how to update elements of the general plan. We have a pretty high goal set for ourselves, and we're very anxious to start the process. And we'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Patterson, I'm sorry. Mr. Lentol pushed his button first. I know you were reaching out. Mr. Lentol, followed by Mr. Patterson.
Thank you. Mr. Crusoe, I want to thank you for the crash course on Planning 101. I'm glad we don't have a test. Since the topic of energy came up this morning during public comment and other things, would you say in 50 words or less, if you can, to comment on our award for efficiency, reference our energy element?
the existing energy element?
Yes.
The existing energy element contains, let's see, Chuck, how old is it now? It's probably going on 15 years?
It's not that old.
About
10 years. So it's lagging behind what I would call cutting-edge technology. It was still talking about adding solar-assisted hot water to each individual home. We're going to be looking at energy in a 21st century light of low impact development. Green building is going to be an extremely important section. One of the first things we have to do is reach out to our experts, local experts in the green building field. Some of us need a crash course. We need to be able to be very conversant in this. That's one of the reasons why the energy element seems to be a perfect fit for consolidation into the energy. It should be consolidated into conservation.
Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would first like to welcome Mr. Stevenson to our meeting in his new role as manager of the long-range planning. Question for Mr. Caruso. You'd mentioned a series of opportunities for advisory committees to be involved in this process. I didn't catch when you first thought that they would be engaged. Did you say 90 days?
I would say the first 60 to 90 days, probably the first 60. My pet peeve about advisory councils is they meet once a month, which is this process is going to move. And so we're going to have to plan on these advisory council opportunities well in advance. Remember, there's 10 of them. And I think if we focus on 60 to 90 days, we'll be able to hit all of them within that time frame.
And that would be just basically an orientation of the process?
Correct. Well, we're right at project initiation. That's what we'll have to do is give them a little crash course and what it is we're doing and where they can help.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Caruso, my recommendation will be, since this is such a major overtaking, if you were able to get hold of the advisory councils to have a meeting just to deal with this issue so you're not lost in their regular business agenda. As you know, they go past the hours and might not get the attention that it deserves to receive. It could be a possibility that early on they might schedule special meetings just to address this issue with you and with the staff. And that can be not be lost with other meetings and a special meeting that can fit the schedule and help you folks move faster than as you plan.
We certainly will look into that. That's a good idea.
I think at least in my territory, they've been able to do that to help the situation.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, if there are no further questions from supervisors, go to the public at this time. Ms. Morgan Rafferty, followed by Eric Wiening.
Good afternoon. My name is Morgan Rafferty. I'm the Executive Director of EcoSlow, and I'm here simply to express our support for your authorization of this revision. We think it's very important that it be done now, and we like that the energy element could be included because there's so much more new technology that needs to be reflected in that conservation element. So thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Greening?
Yes, I'm Eric Greening, and I'm also delighted to see this happening. It's certainly time. Those of us who were alive 32 years ago, let's just think back where we were and what our world was like 32 years ago. That's how old this element is, and so it's definitely time. And I'm delighted to see this effort starting and see your support. Couple of questions. One is, in consolidating the open space element, will we be implementing the open space element? We've had the ag and open space element and been implementing agriculture policies into ordinance. It's been 7.5 years. We have yet to begin to do so with open space policies. Will this be an accelerant to that process or a deterrent? And in that connection, an optimistic note, perhaps Mr. Caruso could say something about the contract with, and I can't remember the initials, it's three letters, some firm that's doing a sort of a biological oversight of the county, getting some basic broad data. Perhaps that can help with understanding, designating, and implementing, protecting our network of major ecosystems, and perhaps you could say something about how that would fold in. In relation to the advisory committees, in addition to the locally based advisory committees, let's not forget some of the broader advisory committees, such as the Ag Preserve Review Committee, Ag Liaison, and most particularly the Water Resources Advisory Committee, since water is going to be key, and essentially the update of the Water Master Plan is likely to be incorporated into the element if we can meet this rolling train as it rolls by. In relation to consultations, technical people, etc., let's not forget SB 18 consultations with indigenous people, and that needs to start as soon as anything does and should never be overlooked. In relation to being able to make the three-year timetable, does this include potential coastal commission action? Does this element have to be accepted as a local coastal plan to be in our general plan? And if so, what is the timetable for involving the coastal commission? And will there be the same policies countywide? Will there be separate coastal policies? I kind of hope we do the same thing countywide, because the coastal zone boundary is actually, it makes no sense in terms of watershed to have wonderful policies that protect the bottom mile or two of a watershed. Doesn't make any sense if you don't have the same policies right up to the headwaters, but perhaps a few words about the role of the Coastal Commission and how that fits our timetable. And aside from that, I just hope that it goes well and hope it has your full and continuing support. Thank you.
Thank you. Those are good ideas, Mr. Wynn.
Good afternoon. My name is Mike Wynn. I'm from Napomo, and I want to thank you particularly for broadcasting these meetings. I was able to listen to the discussion on my way in, and that's very helpful when you have a busy schedule. I do want to add my voice to what Mr. Greening just said. I hope you will include the RAC as one of the groups that you referred to. I think it's a natural fit. Mind you, it's not that we would become involved with all of the issues that are in the a conservation element. We certainly would be interested in water resources, as well as water conservation programs, methods, that is. The only other brief suggestion I would make is that when you're looking for draft materials that you might want to incorporate into it, or you might want to look at to be challenged by them, in addition to looking at the conservation elements of the incorporated cities that are in this county, some of them have excellent conservation programs for water. If you would listen to the community service districts, we also, many of us have conservation programs. I know in Napomo we have we finished one phase, we're moving into the next phase. I think there's material there that would be helpful to your board. Thank you.
Thank you. That was my last request to speak. Nobody else cares to comment on this item. Close it to the public at this time, bring it back to the board. Ms. Bianchi.
No, there were some questions asked, and I'd like to ask Mr. Caruso to answer the questions. And then I have a comment after that.
Mr. Chairman, Supervisor Bianchi, members of the board, several issues came up. Mr. Greening mentioned this consolidation leads to implementation of programs from the open space element. My response is, yes, we're going to make that one of our goals, is to try to implement some programs as this this element comes to hearing. One of the problems we often see is that, as Mr. Greening pointed out, programs sometimes are not implemented in a timely way. We're going to try to address that. Mapping, LSA is the three initials Eric was remembering. LSA is doing a first phase mapping effort for us, where they're pulling together databases, GIS databases, from everybody we can think of in the county who might maintain some type of GIS database. We'll be moving on to phase two soon. Phase one was designed to help exactly with this conservation element effort, and also the countywide plan element that's coming next year. Broader advisory agencies, once again, Eric took those words out of my mouth. We, of course, will be going to those advisory agencies, especially the RAC. We are going to be leaning heavily on the RAC for our expertise on the water section. And, in fact, we've already started those conversations with the utilities section of Public Works, who staffs the RAC.
SB 18.
And would you also, for those who don't know what the RAC is.
You mean the Water Resource Advisory Council or Committee?
Yes. Yeah, it's not an instrument of torture.
Well, some might disagree.
He doesn't get it done in 3 years.
SB 18 is actually in our second group of tasks. We're going to implement that before the well ahead of the EIR process, so we've already got that in place. Coastal, is this conservation element going to be made part of the LCP, the county's local coastal program? That remains to be seen. The staff report originally said, yes, we're going to do that, and I thought better of saying that, so instead I'll say we're going to give it a shot. We're going to try to make this this conservation adequate to the point where it we could submit it to the Coastal Commission. We can't make any promises in that area, though. You never know what's going to happen.
At least you have one support there.
And I think that was it.
Okay.
I did have a final comment. In a sense, I'm going to be sorry not to see the conclusion of this, but, you know, I've been working with James now.
We can always invite you.
God, too many years. I think I probably will come just to hear the end of it. What, 10 years, 12 years? My time on the Planning Commission. And I was really thrilled when I heard James was going to be doing this conservation element.
Uh-oh.
Because I know the kind of work that he does. It's really
no pressure, James.
Okay, I'll get the pin and poke your head to let the hot air. Anyway, no, I really was pleased.
Okay, Supervisor Ovid, followed by Supervisor Patterson.
Thank you. I was going to say, don't let Jim take your pictures, but you know, work on that. He still learn how to focus the camera. The only caution I have is consolidating the ag and open space into the conservation. Knowing how much we went through and the issues that were raised, or divisiveness or whatever else that came out of it, I think you would not make your three-year time period if you tried to put that. I don't have a problem with the energy and the offshore energy. I don't think that those are somewhat very relatively, to use the term, simple in terms of definitions and how they apply. But I would highly recommend not getting the ag and open space in there.
Oh, but they didn't have James doing it.
He was around. Yeah.
Supervisor Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if Mr. Caruso would like to just take a couple of minutes and comment on how these other elements would be incorporated into the conservation element. As I understand it, it's not a complete revision of those elements, but more of a review to ensure internal consistency, and it may not be as big a project as it appears on the surface, and so maybe you take a couple of minutes to do that.
Certainly. Thank you, Supervisor Patterson. And response to Supervisor Ovid, you know, we might be dumb, but we're not stupid. And, we would assume that if consolidation occurs...
Put that down, Vic.
If consolidation occurs with the agriculture and open space element, pretty much it's going to have to go from one element to the next verbatim. One of the things that we're setting the bar pretty low for the ag element for obvious reasons. And, if we can get out of this a consistent numbering, a policy numbering format between ag and open space and everything else, I think that's a win. If we start changing the words, we realize that we're treading on some dangerous ground and, don't want to open up old wounds, certainly. However, we have to keep an open mind. And if there are things that are out of date and are people feel need to be addressed, we are not going to shrink from at least taking a look at them. We might not be in this room recommending it, but we're certainly going to take a look.
If I can, I was going to say that the lesson on this thing is the park and recreation element is it's going to the Planning Commission. And the reinvestigation of the trails program and the agricultural communities very highly concerned about the language change in that.
That's because they're changing language.
That's right. What I mean. That's what I think would happen.
Yes.
It's going to be interesting to read the minutes of this item. Mr. Patterson.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I agree with Mr. Greening in that, and I think everyone here on the board as well, that this effort is long overdue, and I'm excited about the fact that the planning department is taking this on, and they're taking it on as a challenge and as a way to actually improve the way that if this is indeed successful, of keeping our other general plan elements more current, because certainly we're under a lot of pressure to grow and in San Luis Obispo County now, and it's imperative that we have the most current information in place. And the conservation element, as Mr. Caruso mentioned, is really a compilation of our resources in San Luis Obispo County, and we need to know what we have if we're going to plan effectively in the utilization of those resources and in the protection and conservation of those resources. So I wish you Godspeed, and I'm certainly going to do everything that I can to help you stay on track.
What's making a motion?
I will move in that case that we authorize staff to begin work on this general plan amendment to revise the conservation element of the general plan.
Second. Moved by Supervisor Patterson, seconded by Supervisor Bianchi. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Yes. Aye.
Yes also counts. Any opposition? None. Ayes and yeses have it. With that, we'll move on to the next item. Thank you, Mr. Caruso.
Next item on your agenda is item E1. This is a request for board direction regarding implementation of the medical marijuana identification card program.
We don't have staff here.
Was Mr. Thomas to be here?
Maybe they're thinking they're at the 3 o'clock.
There's no time schedule on this thing. I don't know what to
do. No, there's no time schedule except us. Well, if we have no staff, what we'll do, Mr. Lindholm?
Take a 5-minute break.
Taking a break, and we'll give them a call and see if we can have them mosey over.
Well, don't go too far. As soon as we find out where staff is, we'll call the meeting back into order.
There was news. The hearing was postponed the decision was postponed until the lawsuit that they are involved in is completed. I see one of our deputy. Are you just standing up to leave, or do you know anything about this? Oh, okay. Just standing up to leave. So anyway, it's still on hold. And am I happy? No, I'm not.
Can we start with a public comment? Okay, it's 2:32. We'll take an 8-minute break. Be back here at 2:40. Thank you. We help here to get reorganized. We'll start the meeting right at 2:40. Okay. With that, we're back in order. Madam Clerk, if you did introduce the item, and with us is Dr. Thomas to do the staff's portion of reporting.
Once again, this is item E1. This is a request for board direction regarding implementation of a medical marijuana identification card program.
Good afternoon, members of the board. Supervisor Chair Asajian, I'm sorry I was late. You guys breezed through your item extremely quickly, your two items, much faster than anticipated. Today, my name is, as I say, Dr. Greg Thomas from Public Health, and this is a request for direction regarding implementation of a medical marijuana identification card program. Prop 215 passed in 1996. It was called the Compassionate Use Act of 1996, and it provided protections to seriously ill individuals who have a recommendation from their physician to use marijuana for medical purposes. There were some problems with this very brief proposition, and SB 420 was approved in 2003, creating sections 11362.7 and forward of the California Health and Safety Code to address some of these problems. The intent of this legislation and subsequent Health and Safety Code is to help law enforcement and qualified persons by creating a form of identification for qualified patients that is official and uniform through the state. SB 420 required the California State Department of Health Services to create a medical marijuana program, and it requires each California county to implement a medical marijuana ID card program and begin issuing medical marijuana identification program cards to qualified patients and qualified primary caregivers. The Public Health Department is prepared to implement this program if your board directs us to proceed. Participation by a qualified patient in this program is optional. It's voluntary. A letter of recommendation from a licensed physician who is licensed in California and in good standing carries equal weight as a defense in court. Obviously, somebody who is driving along and is stopped for some reason, a letter of recommendation is not as easily verifiable as an identification card with a photograph and a 1-800 number at the state to call to verify. If directed to implement this program, we would ensure the identity of the patient and or primary caregiver. We would ensure that the physician making the recommendation for medical marijuana is currently licensed to practice in California and in good standing, that he or she has recommended the use of marijuana for one or more of the illnesses, conditions for which marijuana is an appropriate remedy. The county, in turn, would then submit to the state a digital photograph and data on each applicant. The state would then prepare the identification card, mail it back to the county, include it on their online registry. We have limited discretion for policy setting within this legislation and health and safety code. We may establish a fee, and we expect it will be between $75 and $100. We may establish a maximum number of marijuana plants one patient may possess. The state regulations allow counties to allow patients or qualified caregivers to possess 8 ounces or more of dried marijuana. We are recommending adopting the state's minimum of 8 ounces of dried marijuana or 6 mature or 12 immature plants per qualified patient. We may establish a maximum number of patients that one qualified primary caregiver may care for. Primary caregivers are required to be consistently responsible, and this is very specific wording in both Prop 215 and in SB 220, that a primary caregiver is required to be, quote, consistently responsible for the housing, health, and safety of a patient. Public Health is recommending a maximum of 10 patients per primary caregiver, unless evidence can be presented that the caregiver is meeting statutory requirements of consistently meeting responsibilities for housing, health, or safety of that person. In other words, we certainly would be open to some flexibility in that area. County Council has opined that The county is mandated to implement a medical marijuana ID program pursuant to SB 420. Indeed, irregardless of what an attorney general's opinion might be at some future date, and county council is available for further comment. Should your board direct public health staff to implement the program, we would anticipate returning to the board within the next several weeks with a fee that has been reviewed and approved by the auditor and with a budget adjustment to cover the costs and revenue program, and I'm available for any questions.
Mr. Dr. Thomas, a couple of questions. One, with photos and all that, is fingerprinting required?
No, it's not part of the requirement.
Is it within our discretion?
I would defer to county council. It's not specifically listed as something that's required, but it's certainly if board requests that we do that, if county council says that's okay, I don't have a problem with that.
And my other question, while the council is preparing an answer, want to clarify the voluntarily term, as is that not everybody needs an ID card, it's only those who care to have one?
That's correct.
And what purpose does that serve if it's voluntarily? Why go through all this?
The experience of other counties has been that the elderly, and well, I'll quote a couple of other counties who say it's primarily elderly and more conservative individuals who want the double comfort of having not only a letter of recommendation that they can show to a police officer, but they want to be on file with an ID card something that law enforcement can call a 1-800 number to double check, so that and other individuals who might feel that if they have this letter, their medical marijuana is less likely to be confiscated, and they're less likely to have challenges trying to get it back.
Now, where does the state law come in? Does the state make it allowable, the voluntarily portion okay, or?
Yes. The SB 420 says that this is a voluntary program, voluntary for the patient, not voluntary for the county, voluntary for the patient. They can either use a card or they can use a letter of recommendation from a physician.
And again, what's our discretion?
Our discretion is it is up to the Board of Supervisors to determine if a
can we say all users must have ID? In other words,
I don't believe so. No, you can't.
We cannot do that.
No.
Thank you, Ms. Bianchi.
It would seem to me that if one needed to use marijuana, and one didn't have a card or a letter, and one happened to be arrested, that it would be not to your advantage to not have the card or letter.
That's correct, but the letter or the card both offer equal weight in court as a defense if you have that at the time that you're stopped in possession of whatever amount is determined to be an acceptable amount.
So it's for your own protection?
Yes, it is.
Supervisor Patterson, then we'll go to counsel for a response.
Mr. Thomas, is it necessary to have the letter if you are in possession of the card, or is that sufficient? Is the card sufficient?
The card is supposed to be sufficient.
Thank you.
Counsel?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, with respect to the issue of fingerprinting, there is nothing in the legislation that specifically authorizes it. And if the board would like us to research that issue, we will certainly do so and can report back on that. But it's something we would have to research further.
Depends on which direction this goes. Seems like it will come back if it was to pass, and at that time I would like to see what's our discretion, within our discretion. Thank you. If no further questions or comments, go to the public at this time. First request to speak is Gary Gull, followed by Tony
Is it Paradis?
My name is Gary Gall. I live in Cambria. And thank you for allowing me to speak. I'm in favor of medical marijuana card, ID cards. It gives the patient a more of a secure feeling and allows more people to see that they are qualified needers of medical marijuana. My mother-in-law is 86, and she has no problem with it, but she's afraid of the police coming and knocking down her door someday, and so that scares the heck out of her. So more of these things help to alleviate these problems. It's been 10 years ago since Proposition 215 was passed, and that's quite a long time. I'm glad that we are having these discussions, but it's taken so long to get here. So many people have died and suffered because they were not able to have medical marijuana. So for those who need it, this is a long time coming, and I hope that you folks will pass it. There's another thing. For 3,000 years, up until 1937, marijuana was used as a pharmaceutical drug and was used widely throughout the world. Queen Elizabeth used it for her menstrual cramps. At that time, it wasn't called marijuana. It was called cannabis. And at that point, it was a cousin to industrial hemp. Let's see. Another thing is pharmaceutical. The federal government has stated quite a few times that marijuana has no medical uses. Yet the pharmaceutical companies came up with something they call Marinol, which is an offshoot of marijuana. It is synthesized and taken just part of the plant to create a medicine from it. Unfortunately, because they have not used the whole plant, they have to really bump it up. And for people who have used Marinol, they find it really strong and debilitating. So marijuana has all of the things in the plant, and so it seems to work better than the synthesized things that the pharmaceutical companies have come up with in a way of, so they can patent it to make more money that way. Lastly, I have a question. In the county, do you have to show a fingerprint for OxyContin?
For what use?
For a use for OxyContin is a very strong opiate. It is, in the East, it's called hillbilly heroin because zoodles of people have died from it. And in our county, do you have to have show a fingerprint for OxyContin? That's my question to you folks.
Okay, and before you leave, we have Mr. Lundell has a question for you. If we have an answer to your question, we'll see. I personally don't know, sir.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your time.
Before you leave, though.
Yes, sir, I have a question for you. You mentioned that your mother was concerned about the police either coming to her house or being down the door. I don't recall your exact words.
Yeah.
Does she have a letter now authorizing her to have
at this point? No, she hasn't because she hasn't gone through all that stuff. But she has had breast cancer and quite a few other things. She's 86 and she's getting toward the end of her. And I have tried to encourage her to get a letter from her doctor because I know she could for all the things that she has. Whether she does those things or not, it's, you know, when someone gets that age, it's hard to get them to change sometimes.
Would she be more inclined to get an ID card as opposed to a letter?
It would be good for her to have both. You know, and then it would be, she would have less worry of having them come through our door.
Thank you.
Tony, followed by Austin Canella.
I am Tony Paradis from Tascadero, and this is my son, Pat Green. Good morning to the board. I have been involved with an ID process through Oakland is where I got my ID, and I had a card for my son and a card for myself as a care provider, and there are rules and regulations up there because I feel that it should be very strict. I don't want to see people exploiting the program because that makes it hard on the ones that really need it. But I did get an ID to hold for him, or if he was sick, to go purchase for him. But I also signed a declaration, a legal documentation stating that I personally don't smoke. I don't allow anybody else to personally smoke in his, under his license or for any of his pot. And even with the letter can be forged. And unfortunately, that has happened a lot. At least with the ID card, you have a picture, it's like a driver's license. You have a picture, your address, an ID number. At this point, when I first initially took Matthew to the doctor to get one, the doctors refused to do it here. So I had to take him to Oakland, and they looked at him and said, oh, yeah, you don't need nothing, no paperwork, nothing. This boy obviously qualifies. And when I told the doctor that he had qualified, he was very upset with me at the moment, but calmed down quite quickly and asked me, well, what does it do for him? And once I explained, particularly with the doctor knowing what Matthew's habits are and what goes on with him, then he really understood that that was the thing to do. And I'm for the ID cards, and thank God to heat that up.
Thank you.
Any questions for me?
No, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Canella, followed by Aaron Smith.
Good afternoon, members of the board, Mr. Chairman. My name is Austin Canella. I've been a medical marijuana patient for 5 years, and I'm a resident of Atascadero. I'd like to start off by mentioning that I think our county is moving in the right direction by designing regulations to allow dispensaries. And since we're allowing dispensaries and medical marijuana has been legal in our state now for 10 years, it only makes sense to implement the county ID card program that's called for by Senate Bill 420. I also think that limiting the number of patients to a caregiver, I'd like to mention that that's not called for by state law. I'd also like to mentioned that the health department should be aware of patient privacy when designing their record retention policies, and that county-issued ID cards will assist both patients and law enforcement in identifying legal patients and caregivers. Another issue with the ID cards is you have to be a resident in the county to receive an ID card from your county, so right now the patients in our county don't have access to the ID cards that are available in other counties in our state. Thank you for
that. So let me ask you a question. Those who are able to go and purchase in Morro Bay, since there's a dispensary there, are they just using a letter?
Right now they're limited to a letter of recommendation, which the dispensary has to then verify through the doctor. Basically, the county ID card, the county would verify the recommendation and then put them into their program, and that card would then be verified. You could verify it over the internet. Law enforcement can call a 1-800 number, log into the internet, enter the patient ID card, and verify that it's a valid and current ID.
But the letter does have the person's name, address, just like if it was to be double-check on a driver's license.
It does, but that's only held by the doctor and the patient, so there's a lot of privacy issues and laws that protect that. When the patient hands over their records to the county, it then goes into other people's hands, and so like certain counties like San Francisco, they have the policy of taking the records, verifying and returning the records without keeping copies for themselves. So I recommend that our county implement the minimal as required by state law.
Thank you. Mr. Smith, followed by Eric Greening.
Good afternoon, Chairman, honorable members of the board. I'm Aaron Smith. I'm the statewide coordinator with California Safe Access Now. We're an advocacy group working with medical marijuana patients and local governments to ensure their compliance with our decade-old Compassionate Use Act, as well as SB 420. I want to thank the health department. I've been in touch with Kathleen O'Neill, who's on vacation, I believe, this week, and I think they've done a great job of putting this program together. This is a critical component upholding SB 420. And the will of the voters, who overwhelmingly support the implementation of our state's marijuana laws, medical marijuana laws. An independent field poll conducted in 2004 found that 3 out of 4 voters favored implementing the law, 64% of Republicans and 84% of Democrats. A poll commissioned by the AARP finds even higher support among older Americans. 82% of West Coast residents over the age of 45 favor allowing patients to legally use medicinal marijuana. These are clear majorities by anyone's standard. This registry program is developed to help law enforcement and patients to avoid unnecessary harassment, detainment, arrest, seizure of their medicine. At the same time, this saves precious law enforcement time. Currently, this program is underway in 21 other counties, and it's received generally favorable reviews from law enforcement because it simply offers a uniform way to identify patients. The element of this that I'm taken aback by is the 10-patient limit that's for caregivers in the county. That's not required by SB 420. I think that it's really not necessary to be in this ID card item, and maybe should be addressed later because just 2 weeks ago this board directed staff to develop dispensary regulations for distribution of medicinal marijuana in the county. And I think that's more of a distribution issue, as well as the setting to the default floor guidelines of the state, the 8-ounce limitation. That limitation that during the hearing on SB 420 was literally a last-minute decision. It wasn't based on any scientific or medical data. In fact, the federal government, there's still 5 patients under a federal program, a quite ironic program, that receive marijuana from the federal government. And they receive anywhere from 5 to 9 pounds per year. Now, and that's the federal government, and that's based on you know, long-standing research that was done by the federal government, not just a kind of a random number that was thrown out when SB 420 was passed. So I think you could strike those two items from this and pass it otherwise. And the county's already under those state guidelines, you know, because of the state law. Thank you.
Mr. Smith, just a quick question. I believe you said this can be a good tool for law enforcement. If that is the case, why is it voluntarily and not every user to have an ID card?
Well, legally, the reason it has to be voluntary is because Proposition 215 was passed by a majority of the voters, and it didn't include an ID card program in that proposition. So in order to if it was ever wanting to make that mandatory, it would have to go before the voters.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Greening, followed by Charles Lynch.
I'm Eric Greening, and I agree with the previous speaker that what you should appropriately do today is to follow state law and set up the ID card program. I think the other issues, I would add a bit to what he suggested in terms of dealing with them later. I would suggest that the issue of patients per caregiver and the amount that it's appropriate to have in possession be referred to the Health Commission. They're here to advise you on these sorts of matters, and I just don't think you have in front of you a basis for making these quasi-medical decisions that should be between health care providers and their patients at this time. But certainly in terms of complying with the state law and also simply complying with your own goal of being compassionate and serving the people of this county, which I know all of you believe in. One thing that's very important to remember is people with serious issues, you know, serious health issues, whether they're illnesses or chronic conditions or whatever they may be, those can be worsened by stress. Anything that relieves stress makes healing or simply better living with a condition possible. Anything that adds to stress can worsen conditions. And having the ability to use these cards lessens stress. So for the people who have concerns, I would say do what you can to help and deal with the other issues later after you have advice. Thank you.
Mr. Greening, Mr. Lentil has a question.
Mr. Greening, if we don't have a maximum, just say the 8-ounce figure that was been tossed out by Dr. Thomas earlier, how do we ensure compliance of people not taking advantage of the system where somebody says, I have 8 pounds or 80 pounds, but I have a card, and I'm going to all my friends' houses here to take care of their problems and be the Robin Hood of goodwill here?
I suppose you could ask the same question about any medication. This county is full of pharmacies that deal with prescription medications in amounts that the doctors prescribe. Every single medication that's out there in anyone's hands could possibly get into someone else's hands and be misused. I suppose if you want to make a very brief you know, sunsetted limit while you get advice back from the health commission. That might be another way you could go if you're not comfortable. But I think every medication that's out there has a potential for being abused and a potential for being in the wrong hands. And it's not normal for county government to get into people's households and decide how much of any medicine it's okay to have in your medicine cabinet. So I don't quite see why this one is different. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lynch.
Good afternoon, members of the board. I'm Charles C. Lynch. I'm a caregiver for a number of patients. I just wanted to point out a few things here that I've scratched down. First of all, the ID card from the county will require a doctor's recommendation. So a person would bring in their doctor's record, give it to the health department, and then they would use that to issue the ID. Also, I'd recommend against the fingerprinting of patients. California does have a Patient Privacy Rights Act, which I believe might may violate some of those patient privacy rights. Also, I'd like to point out that everybody's realized this, I believe, is that the ID card system is voluntary. A patient does not need this ID card to be protected by the Senate Bill 420. Also, I'd like to point out that the number of patients that a primary caregiver can care for is not addressed in Senate Bill 420, and to set a limit of 10 seems unreasonable. Also, the wording of the Senate bill is that a caregiver assists in the housing, health, or safety of a patient, not housing, health, and safety. In some of the documents that I read, there was some recommendations that the board wait for more information before they decide on whether to go ahead with the ID system. I say that the people have been waiting for a very long time for this to occur, and the time is now, not later. In terms of the amounts, as you're aware, the amounts are 8 ounces of dried cannabis and 6 mature plants and 12 immature plants all at the same time. So it's kind of a cycle that a patient could to consistently provide the medication he needs. Some counties do have higher amounts. For example, in Santa Cruz area, they have a 3-pound limit per patient. So my recommendation to the board would be to increase the amount from 8 ounces to 1 pound per patient, 12 mature plants, and 24 immature plants. From my experience, that is a reasonable amount and more than any one patient would probably need in a reasonable time span. Thank you.
Thank you. That was the last request to speak. Does anybody else would like to comment on this item? Seeing no one approaching, close it.
Advisor, Sergeant, I have 2 letters that I received that have been passed along that were faxed to me this afternoon.
Let me close it to the public, as I do now, and bring it back to either staff or board members for comments, questions. And Dr. Thomas, okay. Do you want to present those to the clerk?
Okay, I didn't know whether this would be considered public comment or not, but I received this afternoon. Hello, my name is Michelle McCaffrey. I support the medical marijuana cannabis. I have a lot of physical problems. I've been in 3 car accidents, 2 job-related falls, having to take medications too. I have a cracked hip. I also have a water on my brain from falling concussion. I get bad migraines all the time. The cannabis helps the muscle spasms and help with eating. I've cracked my right rib. I've had a lot of epidurals, over 40 epidurals. The nerves are burned in my back and scoliosis through my whole spine. It really does help. I'm a good, honest person. I have several other problems. I do support the cannabis. Sorry for handwriting, spelling. I have never broken the law. Feel free to contact me. The second is from a gentleman named Randall. I use marijuana to stimulate my appetite. I am very skinny because I have AIDS and I am not hungry. Marijuana helps me to feel like eating. It is helping me with my wasting syndrome. So those have been entered asked to the clerk. And I could answer some of the questions that
please
came up
ahead.
If that would be helpful. Health and Safety Code Section 11362.77 says a qualified patient or primary caregiver may possess no more than 8 ounces of dried marijuana per qualified patient. In addition, a qualified patient or primary caregiver may also maintain no more than 6 mature or 12 immature plants per qualified patient. If a qualified patient or primary caregiver has a doctor's recommendation that this quantity does not meet the qualified patient's needs, the qualified patient or primary caregiver may possess an amount of marijuana consistent with the patient's needs. So, in other words, it would need a very specific exception. Counties and cities may retain or enact medical marijuana guidelines allowing qualified patients or primary caregivers to exceed the state limits set forth in Subdivision A. And only the dried, mature, processed flowers of a female cannabis plant or the plant conversion shall be considered when determining allowable quantities. There's a question about developing, maintaining privacy, and public health is very strict with that due to the fact that we receive reportable diseases from all sorts of sources, including reports of AIDS, sexually transmitted diseases, etc., and maintaining confidentiality is extremely important and mandated by law. I think those are the two questions that came out to me. There were the comments on the 10-patient limit. From a medical perspective, it is hard for me to see how somebody could be assuming responsibility for the health, housing, or safety of an individual without spending 4 hours a week doing it. Although there may be occasional exceptions, and we're certainly open to increasing the number if it can be verified that indeed there is a particular reason. If we looked at 400, that would be less than 6 minutes per week per patient, and it's hard for me to understand how somebody can be a primary caregiver assuming responsibility for somebody's housing, health, or safety in 6 minutes a week. So that was the 4 hours a week was in discussion with some other medical folks and nurses, was a determination that was using medical judgment.
Thank you. Supervisor Bianchi?
Yes, I asked this question once before. That's 8 ounces at any one time.
That's correct. So you could go back and purchase, if you needed to use half an ounce a day, that would last you 16 days. You could go back a week later and replenish the amount that you needed to have on hand.
Okay. And then on the ID card, is there any mechanism for an expiration date or termination of the need for the marijuana?
Yes. Number one, they're issued for 1 year only, so they need to be renewed. You have to come in and do a new application after 1 year. And also, if the condition is resolved, if the person decides to change primary caregivers, then those cards need to be turned in and destroyed. And one of the reasons we do agree that we want to keep minimal amount of records. However, if somebody comes in and lost their card, says they lost their card as a primary caregiver or as a patient, we need enough information to know that we're not just issuing two or three cards to the same person. So there's a minimum amount of information that we believe we should retain, and that's consistent with the state law.
Okay, and then I have a final comment. that, you know, I recognize that there's, I don't like to use the word conflict, but there's sort of a discrepancy between state law and federal law. And if we comply with one, we don't comply with the other. And in my mind, when a situation like this occurs with a medical necessity, one chooses compassion. And so I certainly do support this ID program.
Supervisor Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Thomas answered a couple of my questions already, but I do want to get a point of clarification. You're recommending the amount that a person can have at any one time based on the state statute, but if they do need more and it's specifically prescribed that they have more than that is allowed, is that correct?
That would be the recommendation, yes.
Is that specified on the ID card as to how much they can have?
No, I don't believe so.
Okay. The other thing, too, that I'm curious about, this is required by Senate Bill 420, which is a state law. That is the issuing of these medical ID cards. Is that going to be cost neutral to the county? You specified a range of costs. Is that estimated to cover the cost of the county?
Yes, that's. We want to, if the board wants us to move forward today, we wanted to finish. We've done initial analysis of, and we have a range of 75 to 100. We want to discuss this with the auditor, present the information so that they concur. Part of the issue is that the, two issues is, we're guessing somewhat how many people are going to come in and want cards. If it's 20 people in a year and we've set up a system and for it, then it would indeed be more costly than $75 to $100 a card. We're guessing 600 people per year. That's just a little bit less than what the state has estimated based on our population. That's based on comparing to other counties. And yes, the goal here is to have cost neutrality. People who have Medi-Cal are covered by Medi-Cal pay half of the established price, so that we have to build that into the equation of the cost as well.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Thomas. Since we do have medical marijuana dispensaries in San Luis Obispo County, and we do have people authorized to use medical marijuana, it only makes sense to me that we make this program available to facilitate law enforcement and others in identifying the people who are authorized to use medical marijuana. Are there any other?
Yeah, we have. Dr. Thomas, just to follow up on one of the questions, if a person who's a user legally to use marijuana, now with prescription drugs, if you're given 30 pills to use two a day for 15 days, and then if you want to come back for a refill, in this case, if a person was to use and share and come back earlier than the time it would take him or her to consume the prescribed amount of marijuana, is there a control?
No. The law says that the person may possess up to 8 ounces at any single time. And so there's no control built into this, frankly, for sharing, besides the fact that if they get caught, it is, I believe, a misdemeanor. It's also a misdemeanor if you get there are limitations on where you can smoke. You can't smoke anywhere. Smoking is prohibited. You can't smoke within 1,000 feet of a school, et cetera, or on a school bus.
Supervisor Lundell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While I have compassion for anyone that has any type of medical condition, the law and the system that we have today allows someone to go to their doctor, to get a letter, to have in this letter the ability to possess 8 ounces or less of marijuana at any given time. This card and ID system is only implemented right now, I believe, in 21 of the 58 counties. I'm not aware of a timeline that the state said that the counties have to implement this program by. I'm aware that other counties are waiting for an attorney general opinion, and while being an election year, we might not get that before November, I am led to believe that we will have an estate attorney general opinion here sometime after the first of the year. Therefore, I don't see a compelling reason to have our county take on a marijuana ID card program until after we get an attorney general opinion and after we get a chance to see what some of the other counties are doing here. So I don't see the sense of urgency. I don't think there are patients that are not going to be able to get their marijuana. If your mother needs to get one of those letters, I strongly encourage you to assist her or talk her into getting one of those, as one of our earlier speakers said. So I don't see the urgency right now, and I just don't support having county staff spend any more time and effort until after we get an attorney general opinion.
Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to ask county council what the relevance of the attorney general's opinion is. I mean, how might that affect whether or not we implement the program or not?
Well, the attorney general in July of 2005 issued an opinion to the Department of Health Services at the state level, advising them that, or the department, that it was required under the Health and Safety Code to implement the requirements of the marijuana card program, and said that the department in doing so would not be violating federal criminal laws for two reasons. First, under dual sovereignty in the Constitution, the federal government cannot force state officials to enforce federal laws, and two, the steps involved in implementing the medical marijuana program do not satisfy the elements of any federal crime. So the advice given by the Attorney General to the State Department of Health was that they had an obligation to implement this statute. And that was the same advice that we gave to Dr. Thomas with respect to the steps that he has taken to implement the program and bring it before the board. So the answer to your question is, I don't believe we need an Attorney General's opinion. And the Attorney General's, the requested Attorney General opinion that may come out in the future deals with issues other than the one of whether or not the county is required to implement the program. And it's not necessary for us to have the answer to those questions. I think the previous Attorney General's opinion to the Department of Health would give you a very strong indication of how the Attorney General is going to answer the questions that have been asked by law enforcement. But I don't think it's necessary for us to have the answer to the questions about whether a peace officer is violating federal law if he gives marijuana back to an arrestee or to a non-arrestee.
Mr. Patterson,
So the pending Attorney General's opinion really isn't relevant to the issue of issuing the card itself.
No, it will definitely be relevant if the Attorney General were to change his mind for some reason, or provide further analysis, or make a distinction between the State of California Department of Health and local government. Certainly those would have an impact on us, but the point that we were pursuing and advising Dr. Thomas was that County Council's office in San Luis Obispo County has analyzed the law, and we believe that we have an obligation to implement the program or to try to prevent it in court and have a judicial ruling that we don't have to implement the program, but we cannot decide as a local government that will comply with one state law and not comply with another state law. So it was our advice, and in doing legal research to give that advice, we came across this opinion from the Attorney General to the Department of Health. So that was the basis upon which we have given the advice to Dr. Thomas and now to the board that we have an obligation at some point in time to implement this program. And I think certainly the board has the discretion as to when it wants to implement the program. So you certainly could decide to not implement it today and implement it at some point in time down the road. The people who would view that as an inappropriate action would probably be the people who feel that they need the cards and that the statute has been in existence long enough that it should have been implemented already.
Thank you. Supervisor Lentil.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would ask that we wait 6 months based on the advice and preference of our county sheriff, who's an elected position, and also our district attorney, who's an elected position, and that the question has been asked and raised to the state attorney general's office, and that we allow 6 months for them to give us a response before we make any action.
I'll second that, because there's also a court case pending in San Diego County. And my reason for seconding is it's to get another one of those mandates that we don't get reimbursed. And the other thing is they're mandating us to do a program that's voluntary. And I think Jerry is correct that you have to have the letter from the doctor even to get the card. And so it's a duplicative step, because the letter or the prescription has as much, if not more, effect than the card does.
We have a motion and a second under discussion. Supervisor Bianchi.
Well, I stand by my previous comment that if you have a discrepancy between two laws, the federal law and the state law, the only thing you can do is choose the compassionate course. That's the only, in my mind, that's the only way to go, because if we go with the state law, we're breaking the federal law. If we go with the federal law, we're breaking the state law. That is a totally absurd situation to be in. So therefore, let's take the compassionate way out.
Would counsel is aware of the court case Mr. Olick just mentioned?
That's correct. Yes, the county of San Diego is challenging the constitutionality of the statute.
And what is your expectation to hear from that?
I think that it depends upon the parties, but if the county is determined enough, and the state is, it will not stop at the trial court. Whatever the decision of the trial court, it will go up on appeal, so it could be several years before that case is resolved.
In the meantime, people are in pain, or whatever.
I mean, let me go in order of,
I'm sorry,
the lights, please, and kind of waiting for my own term as well. Supervisor Patterson, then followed by Supervisor Ovid.
Thank you, Chairman Asajian. I want to remind the board that Dr. Thomas did say that this was a cost-neutral activity for the county, even though it was state mandated, we will be recovering our costs for this. Also, it's a fact, it's a reality that people are using medical marijuana in San Luis Obispo County. And I think the ID card, again, facilitates identifying the people that are using them. The letters, which we saw a couple of weeks ago, that serve as a prescription for the use of the cannabis could more easily be counterfeited than an ID card with a patient's picture. And it only makes sense to me that we embark on this program sooner rather than later. So I can't support the motion.
Supervisor Ovid?
The motion to postpone this does not stop the ability of somebody to getting the compassionate use of the marijuana, because they still have to have the prescription or letter, whichever it's called, from a medical practitioner, even to get the ID card. So the issue is, if you've got that particular letter, your ability to purchase the merchandise is available whether you have the ID card or not. So it does not stop the compassionate use.
Supervisor Bianchi.
Well, it does stop the compassionate use, because some people don't want to break the law, and they may have a letter from their doctor that's, you know, that says it's okay, but that will not, well, the gentleman from Cambria, you know, let's use his mother-in-law as the example. Even if she had the letter, she probably wouldn't use marijuana, where she's more likely to use it if she has an authorized ID card from a government agency. That is the psychological difference between use and not use with a lot of people, because believe it or not, there are a lot of law-abiding people out there.
I know. I'd have more faith in my doctor than I would the government agency.
Well, I do have faith in my doctor, but I wouldn't say this okay. one over the other.
Let me come to a conclusion here, and just to share where my own problems are, if it's with the motion or with this entire item that's in front of us. Not too long ago, we unanimously supported needle exchange for the whole sole purpose of druggies who use drugs just for the sake of using drugs who want to hurt themselves, but we say, well, go ahead, but let's give you clean needles so you don't get AIDS or things of that nature. And then with some majority, we approved the dispensaries to legally sell marijuana. So I don't see the argument here. If we did approve all that, this is just a tool to be used to make more honest citizens out of those who use it for a purpose, and hopefully it will become more just and voluntarily used to help our law enforcement agents to better control. I think I'll be a little more specific when the dispensary comes back, and we'll have a few more items to add on that. But since we have already approved very sensitive issues prior to this, I don't see letting this go without probably approval of what's in front of us, simply because we have already approved. It's being sold in Morro Bay. If you can't buy it in another part of our county, you can simply drive there. I'm sensitive for both sides, and I'm hearing the arguments, but on the other hand, against some principles, I supported needle exchange on behalf of the physicians and the patients and all the good advice we got. Having approved that, I feel like this is almost nothing. So for that, I'm not going to support the motion. All those in support of the motion, I didn't signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Yes.
Aye. Aye. Okay.
Is your yes or no?
The yes, yeah. When I ask for yes, if you're a... I know Madam Clerk will follow this, and this has been a problem in the past. When we say yes for opposition means that it's supportive of the opposition. That's where the yes is coming from or the A is coming from. With that, Supervisor Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we direct the health agency staff to implement the medical marijuana identification card
second.
Program.
Moved by Supervisor Patterson, seconded by Supervisor Bianchi. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye. Any opposed?
No.
Okay, three ayes have it. With that, this meeting is adjourned.
What? Could you rephrase that? I'm sorry. There was three noes, wasn't it?
No. At the second motion, three ayes.
To implement it?
Yes.
Who was the third aye?
Right here.
Cutcher.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Okay. I know it wasn't expected, but...
No, it's pretty hard. You just contradicted each other.
I got to read the minutes when I get
Bill.